Here, just
don't say anything important.
I still have my original tab.
I have
a new one.
Is that, what is it called?
Corsican. I would go back and forth like
that. I don't know. This is Hernandez.
I'm sorry.
I still have my original tab. I like hers.
Nice.
I have staff for that. But you know what they did that was
good?
What they did
stay away from all of that, Jackie.
I know.
Welcome, everybody, to the Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization. For the record, it is June 6, 2017, and our purpose tonight is to hold a public hearing on the transportation bill, which is House Bill 2017. We're going to start off tonight with four legislators who are also going to be dashing out, I think, to other committees. We're going to get them out of the way first. Then Director Garrett from ODOT will do a walkthrough of the department's formal review of the bill, and then we're going to go into open public testimony. We have about 50 people, I think, signed up. We're going to ask that people try to keep their comments to 3 minutes, and hopefully we'll get everybody in by 7:30. We will have another meeting, public hearing, tomorrow night as well. So we will start out then. I've got a bunch of representatives here. If you want to come up, let's do it.
This is the all female group.
We get one more chair over. Welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Lee?
Yes.
I was just kind of curious, Mr. Chair, would you like a Republican up there with them?
Yeah.
If you want to testify, Representative. I think you've set it up already.
Oh, they did have a guy, though.
Yeah, we did have a guy.
Mr. Chair, they did break it up and added a male.
Added a male?
Mm-hmm.
All righty. So, whoever wants to start.
Right. Chair Beyer, McEwen, Vice Chairs Boquist and Benz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janelle Bynum, State Representative for the beautiful House District 51, which includes East Portland, Happy Valley, North Clackamas, Damascus, Gresham, and Boring. I wanted to start this evening by thanking you for the months of tireless work you've done on Oregon's transportation priorities. I know all of you have spent many hours away from your families and the workplace working on solutions for our state's infrastructure needs. And the effort shows, and I'm extremely excited about the proposal. So I'm here tonight to speak towards Powell Boulevard, an orphan highway that runs through the heart of the Portland metro area. This past summer, I had the privilege of talking with thousands of HD 51 residents, and during that process, I found myself walking along Powell Boulevard from 122nd out to 182nd. And I can tell you, if my husband knew that I was walking down that street by myself, he would have had words for me. It was unsafe, and I found firsthand that the conditions of that road are nothing short of treacherous. I spoke with families that had young children and grandparents alike who were fearful of walking along that road and faced an extra stressor in their lives, simply knowing that their loved ones had to use Powell. According to the Oregon Department of Transportation, there's been a 40% increase in the population of people living in the Powell corridor since 1990, with very few improvements to account for that growth. There are six sites within the outer Powell corridor that rank in the top 10% of ODOT Safety Priority Index System locations. This stretch of road has 37% more crashes than similar ODOT roads. I'll read that again. This stretch of road has 37% more crashes than similar ODOT roads. As I mentioned earlier, it's downright scary walking down Powell with no sidewalks, barriers, or separation of any kind between cars traveling around 40 miles per hour only a few feet away. In my time walking that route, I was joined by grandmothers going to church and children coming home from school. Their norm has become acceptance of the danger, as they don't have any other choice. And I believe as legislators, it's our responsibility to rectify that. Furthermore, it simply doesn't make economic sense to stifle an already underserved area's business growth with inadequate infrastructure. How can someone open a business when there isn't even a safe way to get to it? The people of East Portland and Southeast Portland simply deserve better. So as the transportation package currently stands, we'll see development in the Rose Quarter along 217, 205, yet we have the same geographic gap that has been left behind time and time again. It's simply not acceptable for the Oregonians that live in that area, and I hope that we can act together and fully fund desperately needed improvements along Outer Powell Boulevard. So the mechanics. In the proposed amendment of House Bill 2017, Powell Boulevard has a portion of the $16 million dedicated to it, which falls woefully short. I'm testifying before you tonight to formally request $111 million, which is the current estimate, for Powell Boulevard. As I mentioned before, it has been neglected for years. I am requesting $111 million for Outer Powell Boulevard, which has been neglected for years. It will allow for the completion of the Outer Powell Transportation Safety Project from Southeast 99th to Southeast 174th Avenue. I know some of our colleagues west of House District 51 are advocating for an even greater breadth of much-needed safety improvements on Powell, starting at Southeast 9th, and I stand with them as well. In closing, I'm confident the City of Portland will be an ally in this endeavor, just as they were when the legislature funded one section of Outer Powell in 2015. We can put this issue to rest once and for all now and get the road into an acceptable condition where it can actually be transferred to the city. I'm joined today by representatives with Powell Boulevard within or in close proximity to their districts used frequently by their constituents. And I also wanted to note that Representative Nose and Representative Reardon hoped to be here to add their strong support but had to attend other obligations this evening. With that, I'll close, let you swallow and breathe, but thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of the residents of East Portland.
Hello, chairs, vice chairs, and members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer from House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I do have Powell Boulevard. The part of Powell Boulevard that I'm going to be addressing today is the part of my district that is east of Highway 205, so it's from my section of this that we're asking for funding for. It is considered Segment 1 in ODOT's plans, and it is from 99th to 112th, and it includes the Emergency Coordination Center, the whole new building with, if there's a big seismic event, it is the center for the entire region. Although I do not want to put the needs of my particular district ahead of the others, I think all of the, from east of 205, through Gresham, all of these are really, really vital areas for ODOT. And I know that this is couched in the terms of the orphan highways, and indeed there's been a huge clamoring for this stretch, as well as 82nd Avenue in my district, to be transferred from ODOT to PBOT. But there's also a very strong feeling that PBOT does not want to take that on without bringing the roads up to par. And they are, as you heard from Representative Bynum, in really poor and dangerous shape. I recognize that $111 million, which is the Portland part of this project, is a huge number. I think we need to continue to make progress toward that. I don't think that the city is ready to take on, as an orphan highway, this project until we get the corrections or the improvements made on it. I know the city is willing to put some money toward that, probably $15 million they can put toward that amount. That would bring the final request down below 100. I also recognize that it may not all be done in this biennium and that we may need to take segments of it and continue to work on it. So my big plea, while I love the enthusiasm of the new members here and would love to see this entirely funded, I recognize that might be very hard hard. I really plead that we continue to make progress on it toward the long-term vision of improving the entire section and then ultimately being able to do a jurisdictional transfer to the city. So if you have any questions, the one other thing I want to say is that one of the groups that's been very active in this for years is EPAP, which is the East Portland Action Plan. You'll probably hear from someone here. This has been one of their absolute top priorities. So thank you for your attention.
Good evening, co-chairs Beyer and McEwen, and vice chairs Boquist and Bentz. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, state representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham, and my district abuts up to the city of Portland at 174th. Thank you to the members of the committee for all the work you're undertaking to better transportation in our state. Thank you as well to Representative Bynum for bringing together those of us particularly concerned with Highway 26. Powell Boulevard is an essential traffic artery in Gresham, and not just for drivers. ODOT estimates that 1,600 people board TriMet buses on Powell near my district on an average weekday, not to mention those who walk, ride their bikes, take the MAX, or rely on some combination of those things. This is especially true of the many families in East County who chose not to have a car or can't afford one. Oregonians need to know that they can get to work or school safely, however they choose their transportation. As a former police officer with 30 years service in Gresham, I have seen way too many accidents that can devastate families of everyone involved, not to mention the community as a whole. One fatal accident is one too many. Furthermore, traffic delays due to accidents are unproductive and can cause ripple effects that impact a huge area. Safety investments along Powell Boulevard would have a significant positive impact on the well-being and safety of East Multnomah County and East Portland residents. My colleagues and I are requesting, as you've heard, a $111 million investment, which would fund the project to completion between Southeast 99th and Southeast 104th Avenue. I encourage the committee to consider the many people who would benefit from safety investments on Powell Boulevard. I thank you for your time, your energy, and your dedication to improving transportation in our state. Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Boquist and Bentz, colleagues, for the record, my name is Diego Hernandez. State Representative for House District 47 represents East Portland. And I do have Powell in my district. My colleagues covered a lot of the detail, and so I'm going to keep my testimony short, but I do want to thank you all for the time and energy that you have put into this work, and I want to say a special thank you to Representative Bynum for bringing this forward and organizing us to make sure that this is at the forefront of the conversation. One aspect I do want to highlight for you in conversations about Powell is the thousands of people, including high school students, who use public transportation every day. These Oregonians cross dangerous intersections and usually have to stay in uncovered bus stops with no buffer and risk their life just trying to go to school. So it's very important for us to make these investments in highways like Powell Boulevard for the thousands of people driving along them every day, but also for the often low-income families commuting without a car and the students that I mentioned. So anyway, thank you so much again for your time and work on these issues, and I hope that you can make our community safer.
Thank you, representatives. Any questions? Seeing none, thanks a lot. Just appreciate it. Okay, Mr. Garrett.
Well, good evening, Mr. Co-Chair,
Madam
Co-Chair, Co-Vice Chairs, Boquist and Bentz, and members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I have the privilege of being the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Let me first begin by thanking you for your focus, your dedication, your sacrifice in crafting this document. It is truly appreciated, and I think the comments last night certainly informed the comprehensive and balanced nature of the effort here. We took that opportunity in this document to focus the professionals at the Oregon Department of Transportation in doing an analysis of the bill itself. And what we turned in as testimony, or the materials here, actually can be broken down into three parts. The first part being a prioritization of concerns and suggestions to some specific sections of the bill. We've identified 10 areas that we want to specifically speak to. We also have some issues for consideration. And then we spoke to some of the sister agencies that are touched by this bill as well to get their input. We'll share some of those thoughts, and we have shared those thoughts in this document. The second section truly is the agency's perspective, as we did a section-by-section analysis. So from pages 7 to 33, we walk through the 140, I believe it's 146 sections, so to speak, and make comment. And then finally, the third section, where we do make comment, where we do believe that there needs to be a statutory, either technical correction or correction itself. Pages 37 through 84 do that for the specific section. So that's the overview and the discipline behind this project. I will briefly fly over the 10 sections I want to speak to and share some issues, some insights, and hopefully some corrections that may inform the ongoing conversation around House Bill 2017, specifically the DAS-3s. Let me begin with Section 13. A lot of conversation about cost-benefit analysis. You'll recall this was a conversation that centered around a discipline that the state of Nevada uses in terms of looking at their projects and literally lifting the language from Nevada statute and inserting it into the document itself. That said, there was a section missing that is embedded in the Nevada statute, and I think it brings some discipline. Nevada does cost-benefit analysis, but they do it for their modernization or capacity-type investments. A project's $25 million and above. I would suggest, given the fact that we have over 450 projects that are embedded in our STIP, doing a cost-benefit analysis for all those projects would be significant and maybe burdensome administratively. But if we're a little more surgical and we place a threshold, whether it's $25 million, similar to Nevada, or another number, I think that brings a discipline that we're looking for overall here. We still have our data management, our performance management systems, data-driven information that informs some of the lesser amount projects as we start talking culverts and pavements and such. So we cover both bases, but we think a threshold would help inform that cost-benefit conversation. We move from Section 13 to Section 71A. This is the distribution of the new funds. If you look within the bill, I think it's page 166 to be specific, there are roughly $218 million worth of projects that are identified, and that's fine. But there's a sequencing of investment that plays itself out, and we have some concerns with this sequencing and the way it's worded. $10 million comes off the top. We have no problem with that in terms of that level of investment. But then it speaks to the need to fully fund the $218 million plus projects that are identified before you move on to preservation and maintenance expenditure. I don't believe that was the intent of this language, but we do seem to stall and not invest in preservation and maintenance. I think we can do things in a concurrent manner, and we have offered up some language that assures that we are addressing not only those projects identified, but also the revenue flow to the basic meat and potatoes preservation and maintenance of the system. As we move to Section 78, page 179, we look at Connect Oregon here. And this is just a clarification question to the extent that we are changing that that program significantly in House Bill 2017. The bottom line is we are now earmarking projects for Connect Oregon. Roughly $61 million have been identified in projects with a discipline to ensure that these projects are feasible and viable for the Connect Oregon program. But that said, recall that in the governor's budget, we have $71.9 million associated with Connect. So The question we have is given the puts and takes, there are several different sections, Section 96, Section 97, that use different revenue streams to pour into the Connect Oregon project. How much is left over for the long-term opportunities for the project? How much money is actually directed toward the bike pedestrian investments that we've seen? Are we honoring those commitments? We want to make sure there's some clarity with regard to that section of the bill. We move from or on to Section 119C. This is speaking to the big projects up in the Portland metro area. I say three projects, but you can break them down into five projects. The bill speaks to five projects here. I think the way we read this, there is a blurring of the financial conversation and the accountability conversation. What the language in this section does is identifies these projects, and then it takes 25% off the cost of the projects. We believe that's going to create some problems as we engage the financial institution and the bonding houses, because these projects are to be bonded here. We'd like to bring clarity. We'd like the language to say this amount of money is going toward Project X. Let's just use Rose Quarter. We have a 2017 engineer estimate for Rose Quarter at $450 million. Rather than taking the $25 million off it and inserting a $338 million price tag there and saying that the remainder of the money is in some deposit somewhere, I think that may give pause to some of the financial institutions. I think there is a discipline to make sure that we are delivering these projects in the lowest life cycle cost manner as possible without in any way compromising the performance or the quality or the reliability or the safety of the projects. I think we can do that through instruments like value engineering. This is when the agency engages my agency engages the construction industry to look at projects to see if there's a better way to deliver in a more efficient manner than what we begin with. And I use the Woodburn Interchange as a project where the discipline and the creativity and the innovation of the private sector actually allowed for that project to be delivered a year ahead of time and $7 million under budget. It is that creativity and discipline that I think we can seek and arrive at both the financial clarity as well as the accountability that I believe is the intent of Section 119C, specific to those Portland Metropolitan Congestion Relief projects. We move, but stay in Section 119, to Section 119E on page 229. This is a relationship between the Joint Policy Advisory Committee, or JPAC, up in the Portland metro area, and ODOT. It is an agreement. It's an agreement that speaks to the use of federal dollars. We believe there is a word missing in terms. We think it's not all federal dollars that should be used. It should be federal discretionary grant funds that the JPAC folks and the ODOT folks will come to agreement with. So I think there's just a word that's missing, and we would forward that in to make sure there's clarity on the type of federal dollar that can be pursued. Mr. Dale spoke when he was up here, sections 119J through M, page 236 and beyond. This is the bonding questions. And at the time, Mr. Dale indicated that Legislative Council is working with the Department of Justice, is working with Bond Council, is working with the Treasury Department to make sure that we do get the language right as we move forward with the opportunity to bond for some of these projects. We move from that section to Section 120. This is the congestion pricing and tolling area here. This is certainly an opportunity that we have before us and should be explored. I think there's a sequencing issue specific to this. As we need to do a little more advanced work up front before we go to FHWA to ensure that we are looking at the financial issues, the legal issues, the operational or technical issues, as well as the political issues to inform the conversation with FHWA in hopes to secure their approval and then move on to the opportunities that we see as a viable way, whether it's on the 5 corridor or the 205 corridor. So just, again, sequencing, spade work upfront work needing to be done. That seems to be a void in the language in Section 120. We move quickly to Section 122.0. It's the distribution of the statewide transportation and movement fund. This is the transit conversation and the use of the STIF, or the STIF, I should say. Want you to know, I think it was mentioned yesterday by a panel, that my agency is certainly working with and having conversations with the Oregon Transit Association to ensure that we have a formula that is correct, as well as the entities that can engage in this conversation. We're working very closely on identifying how we land that, and that's language that we will refine and get to you. We're still working that issue. The Section 134 speaks to jurisdictional transfers, as was mentioned, Powell Boulevard being one of those, but also Cornelius Pass Road, and then two highways down in Lane County, Territorial and the Delta. The challenge we have here is... there is a legitimate conversation as the characteristics and the attributes of roadways change from a statewide opportunity to more of a regional or a local type roadway, and with those types of characteristics. The concern we have here is we just don't have enough skin in the game, to be very honest with you. There's $5 million allotted to the Powell Boulevard conversation and $5 million allotted to Cornelius Pass Road. Nothing specific in this section to the Lane County highways, but I think it's probably in another section that we should move around and ensure it's captured in this jurisdictional transfer discussion here. That amount of money will just not cut it, to be very honest with you. So my hope is, and what I would like to do, is be intellectually honest with conversations that we've had over the last couple years, to be very honest with you, on orphan highways, is to refer back to an opportunity to create a pot of money that the state of Oregon could bring to the table to help negotiate and make the math work so no one is taking on a liability in these jurisdictional transfer conversations. So we think more money is needed to successfully bring us to the table to engage, whether it's the city of Portland, our friends in Washington and Multnomah County, or down in Lane County as well. And then finally, Section 136, the use of salt. While it was discussed, the issues of safety and the environmental implications were discussed yesterday, I would submit to you that the language in here is a little too prescriptive for us, and what we would ask for is a more strategic approach in the way we use salt alongside the other tools we have when a weather event hits, whether it's an urban area or a rural area of the state. We want to make sure we have tools, all the tools available to us. Salt is one of those tools, but let us be a little more strategic and judicious in the way we apply it. So we think the language is a little too strong here. So with that, Mr. Chairman, speak about one issue that's tangential, but if indeed a package moves forward and gas tax is increased from the 30 cents to the 44 cents, remember our road usage charge, that per mile volunteer program that we have, Orego, is based on 30 cents, and that's the equivalent or revenue neutral amount we have when we charge a penny and a half per mile. If indeed we go up to 44 cents, we want a commiserate raise in the per mile charge, which would take it to about 2.2 cents per mile. It's a revenue neutral thing. It just keeps the continuity and the consistency of the road use charge program here. As I said, we have talked to other state agencies that are touched by this bill. First and foremost, the issue of salt has come up in discussions with Fish and Wildlife, as well as the Department of Environmental Quality. They have some current concerns. They want to be a little more judicious in the approach and maybe couch an effort as a pilot to make sure we have baseline information on the environmental implications. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, they have some concerns with the transfer of some of their money to the Connect Oregon program here. They think they have some constitutional language that makes it difficult to transfer, but maybe a set-aside from one of their grant programs at a different amount. I think in the bill it says $4 million. The good folks from PARC indicated that maybe $2 million was the amount discussed there. So there's a discussion that needs to transpire and come to conclusion on that front. With regard to potential litigation, with regard to the legal aspects of congestion pricing and tolling, the judicial department has shared with us there may be some workforce, workload type issues that they want put on the table. Two more conversations to the Department of Revenue. While they are touched in many ways, there is one area where they just need a little more time to implement the program, and then that's with regard to the statewide payroll tax. In the bill, it has that program implementing January of 2018. The folks at Revenue would say if you could push it back to the July of 2018 timeframe, that would better fit with their dynamics and protocols. And then finally, just recently, the good folks at the Public Utility Commission have raised some issues with regard to making transportation electrification eligible for the public purpose charge. They have some real concerns that they want to continue to explore and ensure that the way they distribute that money, as well as maybe some other monies from other legislative vehicles, that nothing is compromised. So more conversations with UPUC on that public purpose charge. Mr. Chairman, those are the 10, what I would say, priority issues that we have looked at and want to bring to the body here. Again, we have a section by section where we have done technical type corrections. We've provided language for legislative councils should they want to choose to address any of these things to hope we can refine and better inform the direction of House Bill 2017 specific to these staff three. So with that, I'll stand down and would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Matt. Questions to the director? From Sam Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Garrett, for your work and analysis. You mentioned at the beginning some concern about the way the bill is crafted when it comes to the cash flow of certain projects that are in the bill at the expense of maintenance and preservation. I want to assure you that our intent is to make sure that that those projects do not in any way delay significant amount of money, close to $100 million a year, that we will be placing into preservation and maintenance as soon as funds are available under this bill, that the projects will be bonded if that's what the will of the committee, and that's not going to be taken out of cash flow. So to the extent that it's otherwise reflected in the bill, we'll change it. At least I'm hoping we'll change it. I had a second follow-up question. On this jurisdictional transfer, I'm not sure. Have we as a group put together a proper approach to how we manage these transfers? Do we have I don't want to say we seem to do it off the cuff, but do we need a task force to try to figure out how to do this, or is this merely already well thought out and we just don't have the money?
Mr. Chairman, co-chair or co-vice chair Vince, yeah, I think it's a money thing, to be very honest with you. I will tell you the Oregon Transportation Commission has policy. A policy said that this it is a joint conversation with a local jurisdiction on the opportunity to transfer a piece of roadway. So there are protocols in place from our commission directed to the agency that you shall follow this. But for all intents and purposes, it always comes down to making the math work, and that's the difficult part of it. We can pretty much agree on, yeah, the characteristic of the roadway has changed, probably should be a local road, or even sometimes it should be a state road, transferring it back to the agency because things have changed, development has happened. But it comes down to the math. So I think it's the conversation, as I mentioned earlier, if we could create a pool of money that helps us make the math work, then we might be more successful in running through the tape. But it seems each and every time we stumble because we can't make the math work.
Thank you.
Director Garrett, could you get back with us? I mean, the $111 million figure for Powell Boulevard, we just heard that. And since I've only been doing this for 10 months, I would have thought I heard that magic number someplace else, and I've never heard it. Yeah. Could you get some sort of data back to the committee on what is in this $111 million?
We certainly can. Mr. Chairman, Co-Vice Chair Boquist certainly will give you that. And if I may, because this is important, the good representative spoke really from Outer Powell, which is really from 99th, as you're saying, or what I will say, maybe a different reference point, I-205 274th. That's the extent of the reach of the city of Portland. Understand, there is an inter-PAL conversation that starts really just on the east side of the Ross Island Bridge at 9th Street and will take you out to 205. Inter-PAL is in between. So there are really two sections. So the good folks who spoke before me were really speaking about the outer PAL. So we have very good information in terms of the incremental approach to that 111. There's a range, to be very honest with you. We'll get you all the information, not only on outer PAL, but we'll get you everything we have on inner PAL as well.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Winters and Senator.
While we're on this subject, because you not only about PAL, but you mentioned that this is all about math. And so if one was to put all the pieces together, what would the math dollars be? I mean, you know, because, you know, we're talking here because we had the conversation about PAL, you know, going, you know, into Gresham and what have you. But there are other areas in the state. And you talked about maybe developing a pool of resources. So what would that look like? And what would be the goal to that pool?
Chairman Beyer, Senator Winters, I'm going to answer this kind of two ways. The first, I'm going to speak to the three, four projects that are specific to the bill. And as we heard, PAL Boulevard, Outer PAL, somewhere, I'm going to say it's somewhere between $90 and $120 million. You heard that's not the inner PAL. There are more investments needed there. So you can see we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Turn our attention to Cornelius Pass Road. You can make incremental surgical strikes. You can make a $5 million investment. You can also make a $500 million investment if you want to continue the cross-section that you see in Washington County on into Multnomah County connecting to Highway 30. The Territorial Road, Delta Highway, I think the number associated with that is $20 million or so. So you can see these are significant amounts that vary depending on what you want to do and what the vision is for the transfer and who is the receiver and so forth and so on. Those type of conversations, maybe not to the scale of Cornelius Pass Road or Powell Boulevard, but as you look across the state, whether it's in Klamath Falls, whether it's in Central Oregon, and the Bend, Prineville area, or even as you migrate out to far eastern Oregon, there are little sections of road, again, that their characteristics have changed. And if we can make the math work, I think we put the roadway in the appropriate jurisdiction's hands.
Senator?
I don't think when we discussed this earlier that anybody believed $5 million was going to make a jot's worth of difference on either Powell or Cornelius Pass. It was, I think, conceived of as sort of planning money. I think you've stated very well the fact that these are two road segments with huge needs, and we can fight about how they got to the point where they're this stressed, but both of those road segments are. To Representative Bence's point, I think you summed it up in saying that we all think these jurisdictional transfers are good ideas, but you get right up to the money line and everybody freaks and we've just backed away and done nothing. So having thoughtful protocols that describe which road segments and then a realistic expectation that not each one of these is going to result in a pristine boulevard road with trees and curbs and safe routes to school and these giant projects no longer can be accomplished by a single funding entity. They need to be pieced together and phased and done over time with funding from a variety of sources, county, municipal in some cases, ODOT, feds. It's going to take a lion tamer to try to figure out where all those pots of money are and then to break it up into segments that make some kind of sense in delivering the finished product.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I think that's very articulate. I think you've captured many things. No one wants to take on a liability. That's a given. And both sides understand that when they come to the table. But what's important is to understand the vision. What's the objective? What's the outcome you want for that piece of roadway? And once you understand that and both sides agree to it, then I think you can start to mobilize the various resources to get you there. And I think you're exactly right. It may need to be several different revenue streams that we turn those spigots on to arrive where we need to arrive at.
One last comment that I would make is that it's quite simple for us to sit in this room and hypothesize about how this would work. I sat in a number of planning meetings about Cornelius Pass, and we would get to a point to say, well, if we're going to straighten out this corner, and I'm making this up, but you get the essence of the comment, if we're going to straighten out this corner, it means that we're going to have to condemn a little person of farmer, a little piece of Farmer Jones's property. All hell breaks loose at that point. And so negotiating all of these different pieces, the improvements on Powell are going to undoubtedly require right-of-way acquisition. The same with Corn Pass. But it rather than these two specific projects, speaking to a larger protocol for how you deal with the jurisdictional transfers, whether they're Territorial Highway, Powell, Corn Pass, these are huge projects.
These are huge projects, and you're exactly right. Well, I'll leave it at that. You've captured it very well. And we have the protocols in place. I think we have that good. And we've been successful in transferring jurisdictions on several occasions here. So we have crossed the finish line several times. But some of these are very difficult. And again, I would argue that the objective and the outcome and the vision truly haven't been clarified, because it carries significant issues, implications to property owners, implications to businesses. One of the challenges we face out on Powell, when you get out there, the businesses have kind of encroached right up to the roadway here. State property, we should probably flex our muscle and say, hey, get off. But if we start to grow things, you're getting into taking that property which was there, so you're biting back the businesses there. This is an extremely difficult conversation. I thought that the legislators before me were very eloquent in the safety challenges. All you need to do is walk that strip of roadway, and you're out in the middle of the roadway. But understand there's a bite into right-of-way that bites into businesses along that corridor as well. There are drainage issues, and one of the reasons we haven't engaged that conversation is when you open up this patient, you get into drainage issues, and the price tags start to skyrocket. As Senator Johnson indicated, there are a host of issues that need to be dealt with, and you have to deal with those and understand those up front before you can close the deal, and it costs money.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. I was looking at your Section 13 comment on the cost-benefit analysis,
yeah.
And that threshold looks like a really good idea when you think about 450 projects and things like culverts and some projects that are larger than others, and that there should be a threshold. I know everybody seems to like Nevada's language, but it was real important to me to understand if you think the $25 million is a reasonable threshold, or if you have other data or other, you know, experiences that says that there is a number that you prefer more than the $25 million for the threshold number.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean, we have, I think after some scrutiny, we've landed on the $25 million as an appropriate level. But again, that's you and your colleagues' discretion where you go.
Senator Taylor, I would remind everybody we do have a bunch of people who came to talk tonight. Anybody else? Senator? Or Representative Spence?
I asked unsuccessfully last night for a couple of the construction folks to
yes.
share with us how far a dollar goes today as compared to in 2009. And so same 6 cents. We were suggesting, as we did in 09,
okay.
Are we going to get half the number of projects, or what are we going to get?
I'm going to get you information that is informed by our economists and the folks who do that estimating. My folks are working on that example. My hope is to have that information to you tomorrow so we can answer that question specifically.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Director. Okay, so now we're going to go to public hearings. It is our practice to start first with people who have come from over 100 miles, so I'm going to do that. And we're going to ask that you try to keep your comments to 2 minutes. So I'm going to start out with, and I'll try to get three up here at a time, Hannah Green, or let's see, Darla
Sturdy,
I think, and Rebecca Jennings. Everybody?
Yep.
Whenever you're ready.
Excellent, thank you. Honorable Co-Chairs Beyer and McEwen and members of the committee, good evening. My name is Hannah Green, and I'm the Associate Director of Government Affairs at the Center for Sustainable Energy. CSE is a nonprofit working to accelerate the transition to a clean energy future through market transformation, workforce development, and ensuring that all consumers have opportunities to benefit from clean energy and transportation. Increased deployment of electric vehicles is critical to meeting Oregon's state climate protection and emission reduction goals. Electric vehicles also provide residents with an opportunity to reduce their variable maintenance and transportation costs. EV rebates are an effective pathway to increase access to electric vehicles. The Center for Sustainable Energy administers electric vehicle rebate programs for the states of Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, and California. And we have seen the power of rebates paired with education and outreach to help grow electric vehicle adoption successfully. We are pleased to support HB 2704 and encourage you to consider EV rebates within the transportation package as a pathway to protect Oregon's air, support the growth of clean energy jobs and businesses, and give residents pathways to reduce costs and participate in meeting the state's climate goals. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this evening.
Thank you.
My name is Darla Sturdy, and thank you, chairs, and all of you that's up there to give us this opportunity to be able to speak. My son was killed by light rail on a crosswalk in 2003. He was headed home from being with the people from the church, and the driver of the train came up behind him. She thought he would stop, and she honked 3 seconds before she hit him. He was under the train for over 20 minutes because TriMet doesn't call 911, they call dispatch. And they had to take the driver off the train and put another driver on to back that train back up over him. I watched the train for 18 months to 2 years and decided to put in to be able to pass a law or get a bill. And so in 2007, I came up here, spent 6 months, passed a law with TriMet to go back to every single crosswalk throughout the entire light rail line to see how safe it is. They had already done it in 1999, but this was 2003, and now we were in 2007. 2008, I went in front of the board for TriMet and asked them how my bill was going, and they didn't know there was one. They looked at the general manager, and so it was something that they didn't tell them. So we came back here in 2009 and found out that they needed to change 80 crosswalks and 45 stations. With this, ODOT is for transportation. They also oversee TriMet. And in 2009, after we came up here, I just continued to follow. And they had killed... they had hit in 505 in 12 years from 1994 to 2006. They judged their own accidents, so I decided to go to the National Safety Board and ask them to pick 20 out of the 505. I said I would pick them. But they picked them. Out of that 20 in the National Safety Board, one out of four was judged incorrectly because they judged them. I'm here today with... Southwest Washington and Oregon Family for Safe Streets and Vision Zero. We did a task force for TriMet, and they would pick their own, and they only did it 6 months and said they didn't have a problem. This last year, 1,200 people or cars, pedestrians, bicycles were hit in a year instead of 505 in 12 years. So I'm here to ask you, and I've talked to different representatives in the House and the Senate, and some of them are here today, to be able to get a task force that actually oversees ODOT and helps them. They can't do this alone. They can't try to make it safe just by themselves. They need help in different people. And what House Bill 2667 does is it brings 12 members that the governor picks. It also has people from highway safety, disability, elderly. It's got motor carriers, the passengers for automobiles, public transit, pedestrians, bicyclists, Federal Highway Administration to the United States. All of these people would be involved in helping them do this. I just have one more, and I will be done. Vision Zero's approach is eliminating traffic fatalities on the streets. I want to see the creation of Vision Zero Task Force in the funding bill. We have a moral obligation to save lives on our streets and save families the pain of losing a loved one in traffic violence. ODOT cannot do it alone. It will take the statewide agency's effect. Please amend House Bill 2017 to include the creation of Vision Zero Task Force. What is a life worth? The gentleman from ODOT came up. He was asked a question about the task force, and he pretty much said it's money. But what is a life worth? Your families? All of us. Please just take the time and think about this task force to be there to help them and to make it safer. Thank you very much for the opportunity today.
Thank you.
Chair McEwen, Chair Beyer, and members of the committee, thank you for your time today and especially for all the hard work that you've done on this bill. For the record, my name is Rebecca Jennings, and I'm General Manager of Coos County Area Transit. I had a list to go over, but I'm going to keep it brief out of respect for time constraints. Basically, let me just tell you a story of a woman that just called on Friday, 75-year-old in a mobility device. My dialer ride was at complete capacity. Actually, it was over capacity. So instead, I got on a vehicle and I transported her. Her only other option in our area would have been to call an ambulance at $1,500. At $1,500, I could have transported 75 more people that day. So thank you so much for all of your hard work on this. CCAT, Coos County Area Transit, completely supports all of your tireless work in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Bill Mosley and Eric King. Okay.
Somebody said they're in the overflow. Did you hear that?
Okay. They'll be coming in. And after that, we'll go back to the top of the list, and we will start out with Terry Parker, Mark Graham, I believe, and Jeanette Shaw. Welcome, gentlemen, whenever you're ready.
All right. Co-chairs Beyer and McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Bill Mosley. I'm a Bend City Councilor and also the chair of the Bend Metropolitan Planning Organization. The Bend MPO has about 100,000 residents and is rapidly growing as we read. I'd like to just say that the OMPOC, the Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organizations, met and discussed the proposal and is in favor generally of congestion relief districts that are included. And I'd also like to say that, you know, on behalf of the City of Bend and the Bend MPO, that we appreciate all your work and really the efforts that you've made to try to address some of these congestion issues. We did have a couple of concerns, one in the congestion relief districts. And I appreciate the overall proposal to both match revenue as well as the project list and allow the MPOs to address some of the congestion problems that we have throughout the state. And we wanted to encourage you to give flexibility to all of the MPOs to basically take advantage and move forward on projects related to congestion relief, not just the ones that are in the metro region. The metro region project is certainly important, but the City of Bend is growing very quickly, and we need to be able to move forward on the transportation projects that are before us. The projects that we have on the North 97 are designed. They're in the planning process, and we're ready to work. They've been identified with a variety of economic development, congestion relief, freight, and system resiliency needs. And we have the ability to match some of the funding that we might get through this package through system development charges as well as two urban renewal districts. So we're in each one of the MPOs in kind of a different place. Ben is in a position where we can't really wait for two more years to come back and ask for a set of changes and proposals. And so what we'd like to be able to do is keep the legislation as it is, but we request that we go to the Oregon Transportation Commission directly in the intermediate period to work on the to offer our proposals on the particular package and the funding sources. And then we're also in favor of the public transportation component of the bill. We have a relatively new system that's growing, and the funding sources will help us meet those needs.
Co-chairs Beyer and McCune, members of the committee, my name is Eric King. I'm the city manager of Bend. Thank you for providing an opportunity for me to speak this evening. The city of Bend supports the bill and appreciates the work of the joint committee to develop such a comprehensive funding package. I also want to make a plug for the Central Oregon cities, so of the Tri-County region, Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson counties, each of the cities in those counties as well as the counties themselves all passed resolutions that were unanimous by their elected officials to support a transportation package. So the region is very hungry for improvements to our transportation system. Bend, like many communities, faces significant challenges to preserve and maintain our transportation system. We face a preservation backlog of more than $80 million. So the fuel tax increase and the percentage that would flow to the city really fills a backlog of about $2 million per year for the city of Bend, and it gets us moving in the right direction. As you know, a street to reconstruct, or once it's past the point of repair, is much more costly to reconstruct. So this transportation package really fulfills that need. I'd also like to address the Connect Oregon program. The city of Bend has significantly benefited from this program. The Bend Municipal Airport is the third busiest airport in the state, and so we have received many, received significant grants from Connect Oregon to be used as match and leverage federal dollars, and so we urge you to continue that program. And I just want to make a plug again for the transit system that we have here in Bend. We have a need, a growing community with a university in town, and transit is crucial to our successes moving our citizens around. So I want to also support that aspect of the bill. So again, thank you for the opportunity, and really appreciate this big heavy lift.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Terry Parker. I'm a resident of Northeast Portland, a fourth-generation Portlander. Equity requires sharing the road, must also require sharing the financial responsibility. For whatever reason, the bicycle lobby, along with bicycle activists, seem to think bicycles have special privileges and immunities, not only to ignore traffic control devices and laws, but they expect everything, including specialized bicycle infrastructure, to be free, as if it was an entitlement. There is well over $800 million in Portland's transportation system plan to accommodate bicycles. Establishing an excise tax on bicycles is a good start, but not enough. Adult bicyclists also need to be paying user and license fees. One two-axle transit bus does as much damage to the road as 1,000-plus cars. On a fully loaded bus with 50 passengers, each person is doing the damage of more than 20 cars. Transit fares, on average, cover only 25% of the operating costs. Public transit is taxpayer-subsidized at over 60 cents per passenger mile. Including in Portland, public transit creates more emissions per passenger miles than measured in CO2 and as it's been measured in BTUs, and creates more, more energy per passenger mile as measured in BTUs, and creates more emissions per passenger mile as measured in CO2 than driving a fuel-efficient car. Transit fares also need to be taxed to pay for the roads. In Portland, 59% of low-income people drive to work. There is a protective language in the Oregon Constitution that forbids special privileges and immunities. When written, the likely intent was to be applied in the broad sense of purpose. Assessing only a token tax on bicycles and unjustly piling on motorist paid taxes and fees when some of the money will actually subsidize the alternatives is in direct contradiction to the principle of the Special Privileges and Immunities Clause. Both bicycles and transit buses utilize roads and bridges. In many cases, have specialized infrastructure that cars and trucks cannot or are not allowed to use. All too often, addition of bike lanes, such as with so-called road diets, also creates more uncalled for congestion. A more equitably balanced and proportional assessment of taxes and fees needs to be legislated. The alternatives need to become more financially self-sustainable, with bicycles and transit users paying a greater share of the cost of infrastructure. Additional taxes and fees need to be assessed on the alternatives, along with a slight reduction to what is being proposed for motorists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you. Let's see, and we have Mark Graham, Jeanette Shaw, and Megan Beyer. Welcome.
Good evening, co-chairs Beyer, McEwen, and members of the committee. My comments might be a little choppy because I thought I had 3 minutes, so I'm going to skip around a little bit. My name is Mark Graham. I work for Jubitz Corporation. I'm the president of the Oregon Fuels Association. I'm testifying on behalf of our statewide association of fuel marketers, retailers, and commercial station owners. Our customers are all the businesses and individuals who buy fuel in Oregon. First, I want to make clear that OFA supports a comprehensive transportation package to properly maintain our roads and bridges, relieve congestion, and build for the future. The 14-cent increase in the fuel tax over 10 years seems reasonable, but that is not the real increase in HB 2017. When you take $8.2 billion and divide it by 10 years, and then divide it by the anticipated fuel usage, you get 46 cents per gallon. That is the real increase in cost to Oregonians. We are especially concerned about the language allowing the JPACs and the MPOs to add 9 more cents to the price of fuel. And that will impact stations inside the JPAC regions versus those outside the region. The simplest example is my trip today from Portland to Salem for this hearing. When fully implemented, the state and local gas tax will be 66 cents in Portland, 53 cents in Lake Oswego, and 44 cents in Aurora. The fact of the matter is that fuel stations in high tax locations will have to drop their margin to compete or lose volume compared with those in low tax areas. An example is Jubitz Corporation. We compete with truck stops from Medford to Tacoma. We check their prices daily. Going into this, they probably have a 2 or 3 cent advantage on us in buying power. I'm talking about Pilot, TA, and Flying J. The JPAC 9 cents gives their advantage 12 cents. That is just not something that you can recover from. You know, we compete nationally for fleets. Yesterday, I negotiated for the big fleet for 30,000 gallons a month. My net profit on it, this is before overhead, is 3 cents. The idea is to get the driver into the store and buy some goods. It just is, it makes it very difficult to compete if you have that 9 cents, then it's not an even playing field. Our organization does support the package, but we would like to have it suspend all local taxes with regional government if there's a JPAC. Or not impose the metro tax at all, rather require the existing gas taxes to go to help out congestion. I'm welcome to any questions. I appreciate the time to speak.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Co-Chairs McEwen, Beyer, and Vice Chairs Benz and Boquist, and members of the committee. Forth appreciates the opportunity to testify this evening. We applaud you all for the incredible amount of effort that you each put into gathering input and developing.
Could you put your name on the record, please?
Oh, yes. Apologize. My name is Jeanette Shaw, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Forth, and very excited to be here, similar to Governor Brown last night. I wouldn't want to be any other place. Having said that, Forth was established to grow the electric vehicle industry here in Oregon, as well as to promote the electric transportation and transform the way we get around here in Oregon. Through innovation, demonstration projects, advocacy, and engagement, Forth is advancing electric, smart, and shared transportation in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Similar to our colleagues on the Oregon Transportation Forum, we applaud your efforts to make transportation investments to reduce costs for businesses, individuals, and state and local governments. We also know that providing transportation option reduces household transportation expenses and investments in cleaner transportation options and reduces health care costs and the economic impacts of climate change. We appreciate the time the legislature has taken to examine the type of vehicles that are currently on Oregon roads. With less than 2% of Oregon currently getting better than 40 miles per gallon, that's 2% of the cars that are currently on Oregon's roads, you can understand our concern and disappointment that the package does not include EV rebates. It does create a tiered registration fee that charges for more money for more efficient vehicles and includes a sales tax on the sale of new and used vehicles as part of the funding mechanism. This is particularly problematic for electric vehicles, which tend to cost more, relatively more, up front because of their battery packs. However, with last year's SB 1547 and the West Coast Electric Highway Project investments, we believe now is the effective time to have an EV rebate. With that, Chair McCune and Byer, members of the committee, while accelerating the purchase of electric vehicles, the state has the ability to meet its greenhouse goal reduction goals. Thank you in advance, and I appreciate the effort. We look forward to the opportunity to testify again, and we look forward to continuing the work with the committee and its effort to create a comprehensive transportation package, which includes EV rebates.
Thank you.
Next time, I'm going to take a glass of water. It's hot in here.
Co-Chair Byer and McEwen and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Byer, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. The OSAEW is made up of the 7 Oregon IBEW locals and employs over 9,000 members in Oregon who work in the electric utility industry and perform electric installations, maintenance, and service. First and foremost, our members are encouraged by the time and effort you all have put into drafting this proposal that addresses crucial transportation infrastructure in West Oregon. Not only will this proposal provide significant economic benefit across the state, which includes increased work opportunity for the electrical workers represented by IBEW, it also addresses severe congestion issues that have our workers stuck in traffic, prolonging work days and project times. We would like to request consideration of ways to support growth in the electrical vehicle industry within or along with this package. House Bill 2704 creates a program offering rebates on electrical vehicles to encourage uptake of technology within the state. We are asking that you consider either adding this to the program or consider passing HB 2704 along with the proposal. This is a significant growth industry in Oregon, and investing in it now would provide added jobs, including for our members, and significant greenhouse gas emissions reductions. With the possibility of this historic funding package and the ever-changing landscape of what transportation looks like, this is the right time to continue investing in it and expanding the electrical vehicle industry and charging infrastructure statewide. If we're serious about electrifying our transportation system infrastructure, it's important. Infrastructure is important, but rebates are crucial. Thank you for taking the time to hear this request, and we appreciate the heavy lift it's taken to get to this point. Our members are eager to see the final proposal and support it.
Representative Betts?
Yes, a question for gentleman from Jubitz. If given a choice, do you think your customers would be more enthusiastic about a toll as opposed to the gas tax?
No. I did a very poor job of testifying, so I apologize. But the issue is that PUC plated vehicles have been exempt from everything, and I didn't even know it till I got here today that they weren't exempt from the JPEGs. So PUC vehicles pay on the weight mile tax, mm-hmm. And so the only place in the state that at a truck stop that they're going to pay 9 extra cents that doesn't have anything to do with the weight mile tax is Jubitz. So coming down here, I passed a Flying J in Aurora, a TA in Aurora, and a pilot in Brooks. Those customers are not going to come to Jubitz if they have to pay 9 cents in tax. I'm going to have to eat that. I mean, and when you were competing for a lot of the commercial fuel business is cost plus. It doesn't have anything to do with that retail price that you're seeing. Big fleets negotiate big, huge discounts. And if you want the volume, you got to do it. And so it's...
But my question was toll versus tax. One way or the other, we have to find the money to address these congestion issues. I'm just asking you, give us your best shot. Do you want us to have people pay at the pump, or should we be looking at tolling?
If you look at, for transportation, if you look at tolling, you got to do it both on 205 and I-5.
Mm-hmm. Assume.
I'm representing the association here, so I'd want to go back and, talk to some of my board members. I think they would prefer the wait mile because that's already the way they're paying.
Representative McLean?
Very quickly, my concept here is, you're right by Aurora, right?
No.
Where are you?
No, we're in North Portland.
Oh, North Portland, okay.
We're in
Multnomah
County.
So you talked about Aurora, but you were...
Well, because Aurora is outside of the...
Got it. Okay, that's
metro.
What I wanted to make sure.
So
the
minute you go in Marion County, you're not paying that 9-cent JPAT.
Do you feel that congestion is an issue for you and your customers?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That was a little bit of what I cut out.
Thank you very much. Next up is Dale Penn, Robert Krebs, and Richard Roche. Roche?
Mr. Chair, as they come forward, you may have already announced this, but I hope people know that there's an opportunity to present their full written testimony to the committee administrator.
We did, but thank you.
Cool. Sorry I was late.
Please.
Thank you, Co-Chairs McEwen and Co-Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Dale Penn. I'm here as the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Co-Chair. HISCO is made up of dozens of advocacy groups, businesses, service providers, and community organizations who advocate for enhanced access to vital services for vulnerable populations. I have also submitted online testimony, and I will not be reading from that. So, in relation to this transportation package, what does that mean? It means ensuring that seniors, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, low-income individuals, and families have access to transit and reduced congestion in their communities. We applaud the work done by the committee to address the issues of regressivity and equity to those we serve. We understand also that low-income Oregonians will pay a portion of new revenue, and our members spent a great amount of time debating this issue. In the end, we believe that the positives gained through a transportation package this year, through the collaboration and support that you've all presented, are worth the added cost of the additional payroll tax and increased gas tax. Oregon is one of the few states that does not have a stable statewide funding source for transit services. This package will finally address that harsh reality, substantially improving transit services throughout the state, those accessed by vulnerable populations as a way to get to the market, to school, or to a doctor's appointment. We also acknowledge the impact of congestion mitigation efforts that can have on minimum wage earners. Irrespective of the positive health benefits, we believe that spending an extra hour or more in traffic most likely has a much greater impact on negative economic impact on low-income individuals compared to high-income salaried workers. While HISCO supports the transportation package fully, our members do want lawmakers to understand that they remain wholeheartedly committed to revenue reform and new revenue to help address Oregon's budget shortfall in critical health and human service programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer and Chair McEwen. My name is Robert Krebs, and I am the president of the Salem-Keizer Transit Board. I also serve as the vice chair of SCATS and of OMPOC. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2017. I've also submitted some written testimony, which is on file. Tell you a little bit about us. Salem-Keizer Transit provides fixed route and paratransit services in the Salem-Keizer area and also in Marion and Polk counties. Salem-Keizer Transit also operates the Chemeketa area regional transportation system called CARTS to rural communities like Staten and Dallas. We hear every day from members of our community that they would like us to reinstate evening and weekend service. We haven't had this since 2009. This proposal would allow us to reinstate this service, bolster evening service, and increase our routes to rural communities. Salem-Keizer Transit's service disproportionately benefits vulnerable populations, including seniors, people with disabilities, and low-income families. Boosting our service would allow us to serve people who depend on us to get to jobs, medical appointments, shop for groceries, or accomplish other needed tasks. We offer a 30-day pass, which would increase 27% of the ridership access by allowing them, instead of providing 22 days of service, we would be providing a full 30 days of service, and including the later night bus service at no additional cost. This would be a real benefit to low-income people. We're also looking at reinstating our student bus program, and we work with charities to provide passes to low-income people and to get to job applications and so forth. We would expand rural community services, and I have more to say, but I will close at this point because it is a real essential service that we will be able to provide if this bill passes.
And thank you. And Bob, if you haven't, if you could give us your testimony, your full written testimony, I've seen you reading it, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Senator,
what's your recovery at the fare box?
It's, I'd say, about 17 to 20%.
Thanks.
It would go up if we had daily service, because some people don't use the service at all because they can't use it on the weekends.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Richard Roche. I'm from Tigard, and I'm coming to you first as a dad that's raised a family in the Tigard area, but also someone that has 75 employees in Portland and in Bend, and someone who's active in our community and livability issues. The number one thing that I've heard for many years in our community is that the traffic congestion and mobility is eroding the quality of our life. This package will provide comprehensive solutions that at its core will improve our Oregon experience by doing a few things. One of them is reducing congestion, and in the end, that's going to provide something we all treasure, which is time. Time with our families, time in the outdoors, and me time, just time. Secondly, provide improved alternatives and new alternatives for people to get around, both with road improvements, mass transit improvements, and bike ped improvements. It's going to improve safety of our system, which you've heard already and you're well aware needs improvement. And finally, it's going to improve our freight mobility. Somebody commutes in Portland every day for 2 hours. I sit by all the tractor trailers and wonder how much are those goods costing sitting in traffic with us. And so these improvements, I think, will have a bottom line improvement for Oregonians as we can move freight around also. I personally have met some of you about 5 years ago, and we've talked about a number of transportation issues. Whenever I see a contractor working, it says time is of the essence, I cross it out because it's subjective, but time is of the essence. I and our co-workers fully support this bill and are asking that it get approved with the consideration of modifications folks have raised here tonight. So thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Next up, we have Susan Sokolwasser, Paige Spence, and Mike Fries. After that, it's Kevin Frazier, Bill Hall, and John Charles. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll start right in. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm Susan Sokolwasser, co-founder of Sokolwasser Winery in Dayton. I'm testifying as a small business owner and as someone who has seen how Yamhill County vineyards and wineries have been instrumental in putting Oregon on the international wine map. When Bill Blosser and I bought our first piece of vineyard land in 1970, we had no idea we would be helping to create a new industry that would transform Yamhill County. But the wine industry has made my basically poor rural county the center of an Oregon industry which now pumps over $3 billion into the Oregon economy every year. I'm also speaking for Ken Wright of Ken Wright Cellars, one of Oregon's iconic winemakers who is on winery business in Chicago and couldn't be here. And I want to note that Ken is a registered Republican. I am a registered Democrat. And while we may have issues of disagreement, transportation is one on which we are of one mind. Ken serves on the Mid-Willamette Area Commission on Transportation, or MWACT, which has identified the Newburgh-Dundee bypass as one of its highest priorities. I understand this committee has received a copy of the letter from MWAC to your committee asking that the OTC accelerate final design and engineering for phase two of the bypass. As value-added agriculture, the wine industry has not only created jobs locally, it has also become a major tourism destination and the focus of international attention. For example, the International Terroir, not Terror, Terroir, conference was held for the first time in North America at Linfield College in 2016. And the National Society of Wine Educators and the Masters of Wine Conferences will be held in Oregon in 2017. Plus, a major wine publication named the Willamette Valley their wine region of the year. This leads me to the importance of transportation. Ken Wright and I want to make the following points. Wineries need good surface transportation, not only to enable timely delivery of grapes during harvest, but to ship finished wine to national markets. Almost 60% of wine produced in Oregon is sold out of state, so transportation is critical. I actually have 7 points, but I see the red the red thing there. So I want to, and I will hand in my testimony.
Thank you.
But let me just say that the Newburgh-Dundee bypass is in the final completion of phase one, and we're in a catch-22 with the future. In order to secure federal grant funds for construction of phase two, we must be shovel-ready. But in order to be shovel-ready, we need state funds for design and engineering. Funding the last two stages would be a major economic boost for a rural county outside the metro area. Job creation, economic development, congestion relief, safety improvements, community livability, greenhouse gas emission reduction, freight traffic improvement, and seismic resiliency will only be achieved by completing the entire project. I ask you to invest in Oregon's future by helping us finish the project, which is off to a great start.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Co-Chairs Beyer and McCune, committee members. For the record, Paige Spence. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and the Oregon Conservation Network. The Oregon Conservation Network, as you may know, is around 40 nonprofits from around the state who are united in our environmental agenda for the legislative sessions. You heard last night from an invited panel of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, the Street Trust, and the Oregon Environmental Council, all of whom are members of OCN. The transportation package has been one of our legislative priorities all session and continues to be. Everyone's priority for session is also ours. And all along, what we have wanted, and we thank you for your work and getting us very close, is to have Oregonians' values of investing in a modern transportation system that will benefit both us and our next generation. The principal values that we urge you to keep in mind as you consider amendments to this bill are that we would really love major investments in public transit. It's not only an injustice to those who can't live near transit and have to spend extra time and money getting to work, but also, of course, as we know, having more cars on the road is also more releasing of greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution. We also want you to urge you to focus on safe routes to school and bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, to fix roads and invest in multimodal freight improvement, electric vehicles. We urge you to consider on-the-hood rebates for electric vehicles and not just money for charging stations. There have been numerous studies that show that having that rebate is really essential to getting more people to buy electric vehicles because it really brings that immediate cost down. And also the accountability. And we have submitted amendment requests with those issue areas in mind. So thank you for considering them. And I want to generally thank you all for your very hard work and for your support of this legislation, and we support it too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Co-Chair Beyer, Co-Chair McEwen, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Fries here on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. We represent approximately 1,600 member businesses throughout the state who employ approximately 250,000 Oregonians. We're excited and really happy about the hard work that you all have put into developing this very robust transportation investment bill. As Oregon's population grows, we need transportation system that is keeping up the pace with our various needs for our economy, workers, and businesses. From transporting goods via roads, rail, and health and robust port systems to reducing commute times for families across our state, it's critical that we make those investments today. One in five Oregon jobs are dependent on transportation, and nearly 350 millions of tons of product valued at over $300 billion are moved throughout Oregon each year. In 2014, in a study jointly funded by AOI, OBA, and others, it examined the economic impacts of congestion on our state. Here are some of the key findings. A major investment in transportation like the one proposed by this committee could mean the addition of 8,300 local jobs. We could generate $928 million in additional economic output through sales generated by local businesses through an improved transportation system. As we have talked about with many of you, lost time is costing Oregon businesses. The cost of congestion in the Portland area is 11th nationally at $1.8 billion per year. The fact of the matter is that congestion in Portland impacts businesses throughout the state. That is putting businesses throughout Oregon at a disadvantage, and many are making significant changes to keep up with competition elsewhere. In one of the studies we looked at, we heard from a mother that changed jobs because the congestion was too much to take care of her family and make it to and from work. Let me just point out a couple things that have that we've identified as potential issues. One is I've discussed with some of you the issue with the payroll tax. In addition, because our freight hauling members do not have some of the final numbers that they need to make their calculations and understand the impact on their jobs. And likewise, some of our fleet owners are still trying to crunch numbers around the sales of vehicles and new taxes that could be imposed there. Nevertheless, the investments that you've outlined in your proposal are critical to moving our state forward. We support the work that the committee has put into developing this package and urge the legislature to act this session by making these improved investments. And thank you all so much for your hard work.
Thank you very much. Next up is Kevin Frazier, Bill Hall, and John Charles. And after them, the next band will be Aaliyah Trent, Chris DeStefano, and Les Poole.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start since I'm here. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute. Appreciate the time to be here. I'd just like to say that the amendments that I've reviewed assume a revenue shortfall. They say, in fact, the system is riddled with mispricing that blocks important price signals that we need for decision making. So it's not really or necessarily a revenue problem. Some examples. Roads and highways are paid for through more than a dozen opaque backdoor taxes, but at the point of use, those of us who are motorists, we perceive the road system to be free. Of course, it's not free, but the fact that we perceive it to be free changes our behavior considerably, and that is the primary cause of congestion. And you will never solve urban congestion unless you have comprehensive peak hour congestion pricing. Another problem, ODOT's Willamette Valley passenger rail. Every time someone uses it on a round trip, we, the taxpayers, subsidize it $236 per trip. It makes no financial sense. Yet every 2 years, the governor's budget asks for another $10 or $15 million every 2 years without consideration of opportunity costs. They get the money. If they're not willing to pay, then it's really not a service, a viable service. Twice in the last 15 years, 2003 and 2009, you authorized payroll tax rate increases for TriMet and Lane County. As a result, at least in TriMet's case, I believe, part of the result is, over the last decade, every single year, TriMet's fringe benefits costs have exceeded the cost of wages by a very large margin. Most recently, the ratio is 123%. Well, when you if you now propose another statewide payroll tax on top of that, you're just enabling the dysfunctional behavior. You have many of these kinds of problems. If you're not willing to solve them, then you're just throwing money. And so I suggest that you table the bill, and in the short term, do something more useful, which is to direct ODOT to seek authorization from the feds for tolling on interstate highways, and that you begin to lay the groundwork for comprehensive peak hour congestion pricing on the Portland Metro Highway system. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs Byron McEwen and members of the committee, good evening. For the record, my name is Bill Hall. I live in Newport, and I'm currently serving my fourth term as a Lincoln County Commissioner. I'm here on my own behalf, as well as my colleagues, to thank the committee for including the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass Phase 2 in your comprehensive transportation package. I'm a native Oregonian who grew up in Portland, and I can recall many family trips to the Central Coast on Highways 99 and 18 in the 1960s and 1970s. That was when Oregon had only half as many people as it does today, when, as you heard just a couple of minutes ago, the wine industry was in its infancy, and I don't think the Spirit Mountain Casino was even a gleam in the eye of members of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. With all the growth we've seen in the decades since, it should be no surprise this project has emerged as one of the state's top transportation priorities. So, why is a coastal county commissioner speaking on behalf of the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass? This project's value will really be felt along the coast as well. I see it as an economic boom to our visitor industry. Tourism is an $11 billion industry in Oregon, and with an estimated 21 to 23 million people visiting the coast every year, it is certainly one of the pillars of our economy. People from the greater Portland area will be more likely to visit and return if they know they'll have less stress and congestion to deal with. The larger economy benefits as well when it's easier to move people and goods between the coast and valley. Less congestion should improve traffic safety. Another important safety aspect I don't think as many people think about is what happens in the event of a tsunami. It is going to be critical to move people out of the coast and move emergency responders and supplies in with the greatest speed and efficiency that's possible. Having this bypass in place will help assure that's the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, vice chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Frazier. I'm here today as the former student member of the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee and currently representing Children First for Oregon. For over 25 years, Children First has served as the primary data center on the well-being of Oregon's 860,000 kids. Our program, United for Kids, works with partners like the Street Trust to make Oregon the best place to be a kid. Today, I apologize for my informality. I rode my bike from Portland to Salem with 10 representatives of the Street Trust to come here today to advocate for safe routes to school. Safe routes to school is sidewalks, bike lanes, and critical education programming, but it's also so much more. Children First for Oregon recognizes that a short walk or ride to school can have substantial physical, psychological, and social impacts on Oregon's kids and especially urban and rural students. Safe Routes to School meets a critical need for our kids. In 2012, half of Oregon's kids were not getting the required or the recommended amount of exercise.
and a large faction of our students were not in excellent or very good health. Access to a safe route to school can make recreation a regular part of every student's day. A 20-minute walk to school can reduce depression in children, and moreover, opting for a walk or bike to school instead of a car is statistically the safest way to school, especially in rural communities. The education and empowerment created by the Safe Routes to School program is deserving of your support in the transportation package. Thank you so much for your hard work, and please let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's see, Leah Treat, Chris DeStefano, and Les Poole, please. After that, it's Noah Siegel, Tim Knapp, and Chris Rawl. Jump right in.
Great, thank you. Chair Spire and McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Leah Treat, and I'm the director of the City of Portland's Bureau of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to address the Joint Committee regarding House Bill 2017 and the Dash 3 amendments. And thank you for your work and your long hours to develop a comprehensive transportation funding strategy for Oregon. The City of Portland, like cities across Oregon, relies on transportation formula funds from the state gas tax, from vehicle fees, and truck taxes. These funds are the primary source of revenue for maintaining our streets, and they are critical to meeting our Vision Zero traffic safety goals. Currently, to meet our pavement management goals, the City of Portland would need an additional $141 million annually over the next 10 years. Because we are so far behind on our maintenance, this year we have filled over 12,000 potholes to date, and that is a 50% increase over the previous year. Oregonians deserve safe streets on which to walk, bike, operate mobility devices, access transit, and drive. Since 2010, serious traffic-related injuries have increased in Portland, with almost half of all fatalities involving people who walk or bike. This is unacceptable, and most importantly, this is preventable. My comments today are largely focused on recommendations to the bill that improve safety. First is Powell Boulevard. Powell is one of the deadliest roads in Oregon. Jurisdictional transfer of Powell from the state to the city without adequate funding does not make it safer. The City of Portland is committed to improving safety on Powell and strongly encourages additional funding for critical improvements in advance of the transfer. I also want to address safe routes to school. In the metro region over the last year, we have witnessed a once-in-a-generation call from parents, students, and teachers to create an environment for kids to walk and bike to school safely. I support increasing House Bill 2017's $10 million annual allocation to $15 million. Lastly, this year, Portland experienced an extremely harsh winter. As a result, we have partnered with other cities to learn how to best use salt selectively and effectively, and we have developed protocols that will serve us well in the future. As Commissioner Salsham mentioned last night, we are working on this, and we do not see, however, any value in specific legislative language that interferes with our local decision-making and environmental constraints, and respectfully request that it be removed. And I see that my time is up, so I'll just close by saying we're also very supportive of the congestion pricing and tolling that is included in the transportation package. And thank you again.
Chair McEwen, Chair Beyer, Co-Chairs Benz and Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Chris DeStefano, and I'm from Portland, Oregon, where I work as the marketing and public affairs manager for River City Bicycles. Thank you for your work in drafting HB 2017. I'm here today to offer insight into the potential negative impact of the 3% bicycle tax, suggest improvements to the legislation, and to offer my partnership. This morning I sat at my desk and I called several of your offices, and then I jumped on my bike along with 10 other people from Portland and rode here. This is truly a beautiful, beautiful state. As you know, cyclists can be weight weenies, which is why the jacket didn't make the cut in my bag this morning. I've worked in the bicycle business for over 26 years, including jobs with the largest company in the industry, and in the past 13 years with some of the most renowned Oregon businesses that lead the bicycle business. I have sold cycling worldwide, and in the past 10 years, I have been fortified by the brand of Oregon and how bicycles drive this state. In my career while an Oregonian, I have participated in the White House Small Business Manufacturing Advisory Committee and the U.S. Manufacturing Council with the U.S. Department of Commerce. Members of the committee, I'm here to tell you that bikes mean business. In fact, I moved here because of bicycles and because of bicycle business 13 years ago, and I'm concerned that a 3% sales tax will have a negative impact on small business in Oregon. We realize that we're in desperate times and that transportation is underfunded. We appreciate the hard work, but often with many pieces of legislation, there are unintended consequences that harm certain constituencies. This tax is a direct threat to small business. The user tax is a sales tax on small business. The overwhelming number of bicycles sold at big box stores, and they are exempted from this because of the $500 price point. Bike retail operates at very narrow margins, and this unjustly affords this competition an unfair advantage. This sales tax is not a user tax and is dependent upon market conditions. If we have a flat year, we won't have the revenue to drive this. The operational costs to our business and to the state certainly do not account for the small amount of money raised. I rode my bicycle here on behalf of bicycle retailers across the state to ask you, because bikes mean business, will you work to remove or replace this unfair sales tax at bicycle stores from the transportation package? Thank you.
Sandra? Thank you. You characterized the bike tax as a tax on small business. How do you feel about the excise tax on motor vehicles?
Well, I'm a motorist myself, and I do believe that bicycles offer more potential for congestion easement and therefore should be fortified more than penalized. This isn't a use tax. This is a sales tax.
That wasn't what I asked.
Yes.
I asked about the sales tax on vehicles that's proposed.
Correct.
In this.
That I can't necessarily speak to. I am primarily focused on a retail tax in a state that does not have a sales tax.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please.
Good evening, committee. Les Poole. I live in Gladstone. And this evening, I've heard comment after comment from well-meaning folks about specific concerns, specific projects, and it reinforces my feeling that our process is flawed, and it reinforces a feeling that, yes, we need to make a serious investment in our roads, absolutely. We need to make a lot of investments. We're in trouble, no doubt, and we can't duplicate what happened last year. We can't have an impasse, so we need to pass a transportation bill and a budget. And the concerns that I hear and the concerns I express are that we've gotten a lot of ambiguous information from ODOT, in my opinion. Let me read something to you here briefly. This is from Pamplin about a month ago. It says, last month we asked a top official from Oregon's counties what his top three priorities were for the 2017 legislature. That's easy, he said. Transportation, transportation, and transportation. Unfortunately, the article is one that also points out the inability for the committee and for we citizens to get the information, the full information that was in the audit that was done last year. The biggest reason I'm here this evening is I searched out two words online, ODOT audit, and I was very troubled. I think we have a spending problem. I think we certainly are going to have to increase our gas tax. But I feel that the focus is on satisfying different interests rather than looking at what are we going to do in the long run to control costs, to improve accountability, and justify all of these tax increases. And I'll close by saying that the public perception of spending is one that is growing, the perception that we're spending, we're taxing, and we're not getting the value is out there. So I appreciate the few moments I've had. I've got some written testimony that hopefully you'll have a chance to review. And thank you, as always, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sir,
Have you had an opportunity to look at the section on accountability in this particular
thing? I have, and I certainly see some improvements there. And I don't mean to be the doubting Thomas, but where is this bill going to be in a few weeks? We're running up against a deadline, and so in the back of probably a lot of minds, there's that concern of what's going to get cut, what's going to happen at the last minute, and that comes down to accountability and trust. So I'm not here to offend anyone, but there was certainly a Measure 97 message about spending that we need to address. Thanks again.
Mr. Chair, thank you. One thing that perhaps doesn't get mentioned enough is that the funding that we're raising on the gas tax side of things is divided in half. Right. Half goes to cities and counties. Half goes to ODOT. So your remarks appear to be directed at ODOT. Do you have the same concerns about cities and counties? Because I would suggest this. Mm-hmm. When I go back to my five counties over on the eastern edge of the state, and I say, we're sending half the money back, they go, that's great. That's the best I've ever heard about government, sending half my money back. And because that means they can go down to their cities and their counties and find out exactly where it's going.
Oh,
right?
Perfect.
Much closer to home. So would you suggest that the problem you pose for us is just about half as big as perhaps you made it? Because half is going to your local folks and you can go down there and make sure they're accountable? And the other half is being addressed perhaps by what was mentioned by...
I certainly agree with that, with your thinking and the philosophy there. And I'm big on having some local control and local help for the communities. But we go back to, what about the rest of the budget? In the public's mind, there's that continued feeling that there's money out there for the roads that's going other places, and there's some misplaced priorities. That's just something I see on a regular basis, not here to offend anyone or sound like a broken record, but that's the public's perception, and it's something I see so often that is part of the reason I'm here. And I do, again, thank you for all your efforts. You inherited a real, real big load this year. And by all means, let's hone this down. Let's get it focused. And let's get something out the door before 4th of July so everyone can have a nice holiday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up is Noah Siegel, Tim Knapp, and Chris Rawl. But ask people, please try to stay at 2 minutes. I've got a whole bunch of people who yet to talk, and we're running out of time.
Thank you.
Please start off.
Chairs to the committee. My name is Noah Siegel, and I have the pleasure of being here today speaking for an interesting coalition, which includes the Nature Conservancy, the Port of Portland, the Metro Regional Government, and Oregon Environmental Council. And I'm here to talk specifically about Section 20 of the bill, which addresses the congestion relief program. And we're here to offer strong support for that program. We believe it's a bold step. The entire bill is bold and very welcome, but this specifically, these two pages in the bill, may in the long run be the most important part of what you're working on here today. We came together as a coalition following on the lead of the Oregon Business Leaders GHG Greenhouse Gas Emission Reduction Task Force of 2016 that was called by the Nature Conservancy. And the co-chairs were Merritt Paulson of the Timbers and John Carter of Schnitzer Steel. And they came together and said, what's the most important thing we could do as businesses to help with address climate change? And they focused on congestion pricing. So I'm here today to represent, you'll be getting written testimony from them, from the Nature Conservancy, from our partners, but I'm here today just to express that there are a lot of reasons to support this part of the bill. First, it generates revenue, which is important for the projects we're looking at. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions. But maybe in some ways most importantly, if you're going to be making these large investments to relieve congestion and the bottlenecks in the metro area, it's important that we price them accordingly so we get the best value out of that system for the long term, so we don't come back here so quickly and ask you for more money to expand that system. If we're going to invest in our roadways, we should get the maximum efficiency out of those roadways. So really, that's what I'm here today to share with you. You'll be getting the written testimony from our coalition.
Thank you.
Today,
Chairs Beyer, McEwen, co-chairs Benson, Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Tim Knapp. I'm the mayor of Wilsonville in my 14th year as an elected, entering my ninth year as mayor. On behalf of the City of Wilsonville Council, I'm here to support the amended version of House Bill 2017-3. As mayor of Wilsonville, I also serve the metro area cities as the representative to JPAC. In that capacity, I represent the cities of Gladstone, Happy Valley, Johnson City, Lake Oswego, Milwaukee, Oregon City, River Grove, West Lynn, and Wilsonville. First off, I want to say that the mayors and city council members of these communities greatly appreciate the leadership that you have shown, working to develop a broad, multi-pronged approach to transportation needs. Clackamas County cities support the concept of the metro area going Dutch with the state to fund major highway congestion transportation projects. We request that the legislature do amend the bill to clarify that the regional surcharge should be for the proposed metro congestion relief district be mandated by the Oregon legislature with concurrence or acceptance by JPAC. We also seek to establish a clear statutory policy that funds raised through the regional surcharge be spent efficiently and responsibly, and that these revenues be placed in a separate district congestion relief subfund. The City of Wilsonville also operates the South Metro Area Regional Transit Agency, which is Portland region's other urban area transit provider. SMART serves a crucial role, providing some 300,000 rides per year, primarily for commuting employees who fill 90% of the 20,000 jobs in Wilsonville. SMART also provides paratransit services to the elderly and disabled. SMART operates fixed routes connecting Salem-Keizer and Canby to Wilsonville and coordinates with TriMet on the West commuter train that serves Wilsonville, Tualatin, Tigard, and Beaverton. SMART buses meet each West train that arrives and whisks employees to their Wilsonville employers within 10 minutes of arrival. The bill currently appears to omit public transit services operated by cities as a qualified entity to be a recipient of new transit funds. I strongly encourage an amendment that clarifies that municipal transit agencies would qualify to receive such funding. Most importantly, funds from the new transit employment tax should be returned to the jurisdictional area transit provider from which the tax originates in order to continue providing better transit services. The Oregon Employment Department regularly provides the city with aggregated employee earnings data segmented by industry type. For 2015, employment data reported that Wilsonville-based employers had an aggregate payroll of $1.17 billion. Increased funding resources would enable SMART to provide more frequent bus runs. Improved transit services can provide I-5 congestion relief by giving commuters more transportation options. We also support the specific project inclusion in Section 119I2, page 236, item B, the Boone Bridge Lanes Project. And we further support adding a project for a South I-5 Metro Corridor study. This study would look at a range of multimodal transportation issues to improve the movement of freight, commuters, local and interstate traffic along the I-5 corridor stretching from as far as Salem-Keizer in the south past Wilsonville and I-205 to Highway 217 and Portland. Thank you very much.
Mayor, Chris.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I am Chris Rawl, the Pacific Northwest Program Manager for Transportation for America. We're an alliance of civic business and elected leaders working to increase state and federal investment in locally driven transportation solutions. And our team has been tracking state transportation packages across the country since about 2012. At this point, more than half of states have moved packages, so Oregon's catching up a little bit here. The written testimony I've submitted really focuses on the idea of return on investment and that screen and way and lens of looking at how we could improve upon the package. And just to summarize a few key points in there, one is looking at this idea of cost-benefit analysis. I agree with the earlier comments from the OTC and ODOT. It should be focused on the right set of projects. Looking at modernization and expansion makes sense. But then let's go a step further and think about how can you actually use this to inform decisions? What are the benefits that we want to include and consider in cost-benefit analysis, and also how can we use it to compare between projects and make the decisions and prioritize the projects that are providing the most value? In terms of opportunity to right-size projects, in the 2009 JTA, Least cost planning and practical design were tools that ODOT has developed since then, coming from that legislation. And to really carry that forward, there's an opportunity to include some language in this bill to try to strengthen that up and look at corridors like I-5, where we could look at some different options for how to address corridors like that. As far as active transportation, let's not be penny wise and pound foolish. It's a huge opportunity. It's incredibly popular, huge set of benefits from health to congestion relief to improve student performance as far as safe routes to school. So let's step up and invest there. Some of the things that are really positive in this package: congestion pricing, really critical. This is the long-term solution to congestion. Increased authority and capacity and independence for the OTC to oversee ODOT. That's going to be really helpful in terms of having greater oversight there and accountability and transparency. And then finally, the $107 million annual investment in transit is critical. Currently, Oregon funds 3% of transit operations in the state, compared with 24% of operations that's supported by states nationwide. This is really going to get Oregon to have skin in the game on transit. So I applaud you for including that in the package. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
As the next group comes up, Mr. Mayor, if the bill remains unamended with respect to the imposition of local taxes, will you remain supportive?
Broadly supportive, but not going to be as easy to produce the benefits that it otherwise could produce.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. David Bouchard, Alex Kyler, and Pamela Mikeworth. Again, the shorter the better, if
yes.
You can. I have a bunch of people yet to testify, and we're sort of as far in as we wanted to go, but... Someone start?
Sure.
Okay. Committee members, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and I'd like to begin by thanking you very much for producing House Bill 2017. This bill does have safety priorities throughout it, and when the interim committee came to Lane County during late summer of 2016, you heard a great deal about safety priorities for Lane County. We have the unfortunate title of having the most fatalities in the state of Oregon on our roadways, and most of those occur on rural roadways. That leads me to the topic of territorial highway. In 2006, we had a tragic fatality on that roadway, and in fact, the accident led to the development of the share the road bicycle plates, as well as the definition of a vulnerable user of a right-of-way, which policies were constructed around that definition. Territorial highway, I want to thank the director for bringing it up during his discussion about jurisdictional transfer. I want to emphasize to the committee that jurisdictional transfer is guidance from the OTC on that, and we've tried twice with the department to get to across the finish line with a Delta Highway territorial highway swap. We, at this point in time, because of the costs delta between those two roads, would much prefer in Section 71 of the bill if we could just get the project funded that would eliminate the most dangerous part of that road. We've already established jurisdictional transfer agreements as part of that project, and thus we would really request that the committee focus just on this 5.7-mile stretch of project that's already been scoped and gone through an alternatives analysis. Thank you.
All right. Good evening, Co-Chair McEwen, Co-Chair Beyer, and members of the committee. My name is David Bouchard, and I'm a transit-dependent student at Portland State University. I'm here today to talk about HB 2017. It's an advocate and leader in a transportation, grassroots transportation justice organization, Bus Riders Unite. This bill is extremely important to me. This transportation package has the potential to expand economic opportunity to low-income individuals by connecting them to public transit. As you should know, transportation and mobility plays a huge role in the struggle for equal opportunity and is what gets people of color, low-income individuals with low-income individuals, people with disabilities such as myself, seniors and youth who depend on transit to our schools, our homes, our jobs, our doctor's appointments, our friends, and other vital opportunities every day. Public transportation is a true lifeline for us. That's really the only way I get around throughout the whole state in Portland, so it is extremely important. But instead, this transportation package, while including some more funding for transit, also includes regressive funding mechanisms that will continue to disproportionately impact those same communities while essentially maintaining the status quo that we've had all along in favor of automobiles. I am especially concerned with the employee payroll tax, what I call a wage tax, a burdensome tax on wages. We know that a progressive income tax would raise more revenue and is more equitable. Yet we were told that in this political climate, this option was a non-starter. With so much at stake, this attitude towards your constituents is unacceptable. Our environmental justice communities are already experiencing a housing crisis. As we continue to be priced out of our homes, we are pushed farther and farther away from accessible and affordable transit, which we rely on to get where we need to go. And I'll give you an example. I have a friend in Portland, right now lives at 74th and Killingsworth, which is already not a great area of the city for livability and safety, but it's on a bus line that runs very late in about every 10 to 15 minutes. Now she's got to move out to 148th and Sandy in Portland, where I don't even know if you can walk the over half a mile to her house from the bus, which only runs, you know, twice an hour, less than that on weekends. So that's just one example of thousands. And it's important for this package to make sure that public transit investment doesn't fall through the cracks. This package needs to address clear commitment from agencies to make transit more affordable and accessible. It needs to make sure that the $107 million allocated annually doesn't place the burden on low-income people. It is imperative that every last cent of this money be utilized for fare relief opportunities along with enhanced transit service. Every cent. I ask that you approve the amendments to ensure this requirement is clearly stated. I also ask that you take into consideration the needs of communities of color, people with disabilities such as myself, youth, seniors, and poor rural communities, because we are your primary constituents and riders. Thanks.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Pamela Mike Worth. I'm a resident of Washington County. I also work for Washington County Community Corrections. I work part-time. I am semi-retired, which is going to be the rest of my life, is semi-retired since I can't afford to retire. But TriMet has given me another choice, an alternative. I may choose to continue to drive my car, which I have, or I can, for under $20 a month, have an honored citizen TriMet pass, which gives me access to the MAX line and the bus system throughout the Tri-County area, which is about all I travel. For, like I say again, for less than $20 a month, I can go anywhere at any time that TriMet goes. So that's pretty nice. and I do use it. Yesterday, I got on the 76 bus a few blocks from my house, and I rode up to the Tiger Library, and I went, took my book, and I rode at 76 further up to Cook Park, and I walked through Cook Park, had a lovely day, and came back home, and it cost me pennies. So for seniors and honored citizens, which I am now, it's a great deal. It's the best deal going. I love it. And if I get to the point that I can't drive anymore, I live in a city in a tri-county area with excellent transportation, and I'm really proud of that. Also, I was thinking of, I have a choice to drive a right transit right now at low cost. Working for Community Corrections, part of, I am a counselor there at the Restitution Center. Our probationers, we have the program in the treatment dorm, which is addiction. Probationers with addiction issues, we give them treatment there. They are required, part of their probation, to leave the Restitution Center is they must have a job and they must have housing. We provide, Washington County provides TriMet bus passes for them to get to their NAAA meetings, to go job hunting, to get to their jobs, and so without the TriMet passes and the ability to get somewhere, these people often have lost all driving privileges. So it's a segment of the population that are trying to get back into the workforce and so on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gary Holden, John Sponsine.
I think so.
Fonsine, and let's see, Terry Clark. Which one? S-P-O-R-S-E-E-N. Is that you?
That's me.
Thank you.
Did you say Gary?
Sorry about that if I mispronounced.
Yes, yes, Gary.
Please, we're running, I'm running out of time, so.
You won't hear me very long.
Are you? I'm going to help him. But if we could get an extra seat, I want him to sit.
Yeah, go help him.
Why don't you go
ahead?
Okay, and then I'll just
sit
back and you can take it. Okay.
Let's go. Please.
Hi. My name is Meg. I signed up to testify as well, but I ended up sitting next to Gary Holden, who is deaf and had requested an interpreter, but there was no interpreter, so we had a chance to chat, and he wanted me to just pass on his thoughts, if that's okay, and
okay,
I'll give
please.
My testimony later. Okay, great. So Gary is from the Durham to Wallaton area. He is deaf. He uses ASL, and he is also a proud car-free senior. He wanted to communicate how important it is for him to use public transportation. He doesn't want to live in Portland, but he does need to be somewhat close to a metro area. But he uses the bus and the MAX and the C train in order to get around into Wallaton. He also wanted to add that he does not want to depend on other people or ask other people for rides. He is proudly independent in the transportation that he uses, and wants to continue to ask for and advocate for transportation funding. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Sorry, I'm Terry Clark. I am a warehouse worker. I work a couple jobs, so anyone who ever sees me, I'm usually working 2 to 3 jobs. I live on my own. I don't have any kids, no spouse or anything, so I pay everything myself. And I would really hope to see low-income funding or for the transit, because our bus passes are just way too much. I think it's ridiculous to pay 3 digits for a month that only has 2. Month only has 30 to 31 days. We pay $100. Like, it's ridiculous to pay $100 a month for a pass. But yeah, I do. I work very hard. I work a full time and a part time just to keep rent and everything. And the housing doesn't really, it's not in sync with the payments that we're going, and everyone is getting evicted and stuff. And I'm just very tired and worked, and I would really love to see my community and other people who are around my age group, the adults. I think the youth are taken care of with their bus passes and transit and everything. The seniors are taken care of, but the adults who ride back and forth on the train and are crowded with 2 and 3 maxes that are like filled up from car to car during 3 to 5, it's like, it's crazy. And we work very hard for this. So I would like to see the low-income people funded for this.
Thank you.
I didn't have anything prepared, and I'm not very good at talking out loud.
Sorry. Well. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sir.
Hi, my name is, excuse me, I'm John Sporsine, and I appreciate being able to talk to you. I am a pro-transit person completely. I'm also a very extemporaneous speaker who wasn't even going to be here today, so whipped out a extemporaneous email that I sent to all of you yesterday, and then got all excited and accidentally sent it a second time. So you got two pieces to read. I will say this, on the way down here, I was thinking what I was going to say, and I changed my mind about 5 times, and then when I was going to just talk transit, but then I heard the first 4 people speak, and it just threw me for a loop. And so all I'm going to say is that I drove Powell Boulevard yesterday, and I'm proud that I missed. I was able to swerve and miss potholes and not sideswipe any cars or kill any bicyclists. And I made it the whole length of Powell, doing the 2 things that I needed to do along there. But worse than that, in 1959 in June, this month in 1959, I was a passenger in a car going out Powell Boulevard, and 2 people coming the other way, and there were 4 people in the car I was in. 2 people in a car coming the other way, we met head on. I woke up about a month later in Providence Hospital, the only survivor. It's kind of bugged me the rest of my life. every time I think about it, I was kind of sorry to think about it today. But so all I'm saying is, go Powell. Do what you can for Powell Boulevard. That's all I really want to say.
Thank you very much. Terry Clark, Leon... I can't read the last name. Sure, okay. And Bob Grover.
She is already came up. So.
She already came up? Okay. So Bob Grover and Keith Peel, it looks like. And again, to the extent we can keep it short, that's helpful. I got a long list and we're past time. Please, someone start.
Okay, I'll start. Okay, good evening, committee members. Okay, my name is Leon Chavarria. I have epilepsy. Transportation is extremely important to me. I ride the TriMet system several times a week, especially if it's a nice day. But I'm worried that if you don't pass this bill, our difficulties will be worse. Bridges will become worn down with traffic and so need repair, exacerbating everybody's problems. The multitude of people who live outside of Portland in the lush countryside, though, they're unable to get around with transit. So TriMet is an answer. Especially with a low income fare for people over 55. Seniors, as well as friends like myself with disabilities, as well as TriMet's Lyft program, which I use when my strength is drained after a seizure and when I have to pick up a prescription. So please assist these people, students, children, moms, dads, older folks, and the disabled. I've never been able to drive, so getting around to an appointment or pick up something like groceries, clothes, coffee, or medication, which I need every day and every month. So I thank you for your compassion in seeing things from our point of view. So I hope you will pass this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Good evening, co-chairs, vice chairs, and committee members. My name is Keith Peel. I'm the immediate past chair of the board at the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, and I also sit on the Transportation Committee at Westside Economic Alliance. I'm here tonight for one reason and one reason only, which is to implore you to pass House Bill 2017. And I had the occasion week before last to spend the whole week in Washington, D.C. with a whole constituency of colleagues doing nothing but talking about transportation. And a couple of key elements came through from that conversation. One is that 16 states across the country have recently passed a gas tax, and nobody lost a seat, nobody gave up their position, and those states are progressively moving forward to solve their transportation problems. The administration is talking about significant investment. We're there talking about significant reinvestment at the federal level in transportation dollars. As a matter of fact, we get a clear message that those states that are willing to invest in their transportation system will actually be on a short list of those that probably will to receive some additional consideration for those dollars as they come. We got a presentation from the Federal Highway Administration. Currently, that's $5.40 worth of economic return for every dollar that we invest in transportation. Folks, I'm not here to sit and tell you what's right or wrong in this thing. I've been involved in the transportation discussions the last 25 years. I've been in the industry for 40. This is the best proposal that I've seen come along. There is something in this for everyone. There's something in it that probably somebody won't like. But at the end of the day, zero times zero is zero. And if we don't do something to invest the hole in the roof and fix what we've got in front of us, we're kicking the can down the road. I heard an impassioned speech from Representative Blumenauer. Now, Mr. Blumenauer and I probably aren't going to chop cotton together and probably won't agree on much about anything. But the one thing we both agree on is that we are both passionate about transportation. And he implored us as citizens of this state, as people in the local business community, to go back home and talk to our people in the community, talk to our legislators about the need to pass transportation improvements and transportation infrastructure investments. You have that opportunity in front of you. You thought big. You presented big. You've got a big package. Do the right thing. Show your leadership. It's not partisanship here. It's what we need as a state and as people of this state. So thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
All right, chairs, committee, I'll keep it brief because Keith took part of my time. But I just would like to applaud you for this bill and encourage you to stay bold. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of special interests. There's a lot of issues here that we could pick this apart. We as the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, my name is Bob Grover, I'm current chair of the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, are here in high support of this. We is our legislative agenda, it's our number one priority, and it's really the only thing that we're focusing on right now in the legislature is the metropolitan area and the state is crippled by transportation-related issues, and we need to take a bold approach, and we believe you have done that here, and as predecessor here, it said not everybody's going to be happy about it. There's a lot of specifics that we could improve, but we need a package, and this is the best package we've seen in years. I think the most important things, we're focusing on bottleneck, we're focusing on freight mobility, we're focusing on having this be a well-rounded multimodal. This is the first true multimodal, and multimodal does mean investing in vehicle transportation and freight transportation, and it's also a wide variety, and it's going to make sure everybody pays their fair share. This will impact all of our members. Not all of our members will like every piece of it. Not all of our members will like every project, but it is something that we are in high support of and encourage you, as Keith said, is take a leadership position, push this through. I haven't really heard anybody opposed to this bill yet today, so hopefully it keeps going this way, and hopefully you will push this through, and we will get a transportation package for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Sheryl Bishop, Robert Ping, and I think it's Oliver Penny. They're okay. Great. Whoever wants to start, I'm pushing time tonight.
Hi, chairs, co-chairs, and rest of the committee members, thank you for your time. Thanks for giving up your evening. My name is Robert Allen Ping, Portland resident. This is my son, Oliver. I'm here with two hats on. One is a parent, the most important hat, but second, I am the executive director of the Walkable and Livable Communities Institute. Spent the last 21 years of my career working on getting kids to be more active, safer, and making their neighborhoods better places to live. So I'm going to focus on the Safe Routes to School program. First, though, thank you for including transit into this package. Thanks for the congestion pricing mechanisms. I have some other comments about other things that I'll submit in writing, but as far as Safe Routes to School goes, thank you for including that into the package. Of course, we could always use more money for it. $10 million is a good start, but this Safe Routes to School is a long-term program. As I mentioned, I've been doing it for 21 years. I was on the Congressional Safe Routes to School Task Force, the technical director for the Safe Routes National Partnership, the founding manager of Portland Safe Routes to School program, and was an advisor for ODOT on Safe Routes to School. I've seen and participated in thousands of Safe Routes to School programs around the country, analyzed, tracked, and studied Japan, Canada, Northern Europe, and U.S. programs. And I can tell you a few things about what's in there now. There's a great return on investment, but we don't want the thing to sunset. As I mentioned, it's a multi-year program. We're talking about behavior change. We're talking about infrastructure change. If you build it, they won't necessarily come. Parents have a lot of reasons that they don't let their kids out and about in the neighborhoods. Infrastructure is critical piece we have to address, so thank you for doing that. But we also need to address programming as well. You've heard from a couple other speakers about education and encouragement. I think those actually might be as important as the infrastructure, because parents are worried about personal crime and other issues that they are worried about, and the encouragement and education is going to help with that. We want people to be good drivers, too. And ultimately, traffic safety education, which is part of Safe Routes to School, is going to make people better drivers, whether they ever walk or bike to school. The 40% match, understand the reasoning for that. The lower income communities are going to stall and not be able to come up with that match. I can guarantee that. So if there's a way we can get Title I schools to be assisted through the program so they don't have to come up with the match, or at least a reduced amount of percentage for them, that'll make a huge difference. And lower income communities typically have the worst infrastructure, the longer distances to travel, and folks that, you know, can't afford cars or won't drive cars. The quarter mile boundary, school catchment areas are all sizes and shapes. The hot button issues for getting kids to walk and bike might be past that quarter mile. Most of the schools in the state are at a mile for elementary, a mile and a half for middle schools. And so we also then put parents in the position of having to then find their own way between that mile and quarter mile of getting their kids to school, and they will end up driving most of the time if there aren't infrastructure changes or programmatic changes that make it more, make them more confident about their kids being out and about. And then, you know, HB 3230 has some great language in it. You could adopt some of their Safe Routes to School language into this one, and that would be certainly an improvement. But overall, thank you very much for including this stuff in the bill. Did you want to say anything there? Okay, go for it.
Please.
My name's Oliver, and I have been walking and biking, well, mostly biking, to my school for a while, like about 3 years. And there's this really busy street that's like people are going like 30 miles an hour across, and there's no crosswalk at all.
Uh-huh.
And once I was going across it, and I almost got hit by this person who was just speeding and just this. Please just more for walking and biking to school.
Thank you, Oliver.
Thank you.
Nicely done, Oliver. Thank you.
Please.
Hi. Thank you for having me today, and I'm glad to be here. And I basically support all the.
Could you give your name, please, for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Sherelle Bishop, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. I was born and raised there. But one thing, well, I support all of the needs right now that I hear coming from the testimony, all the testimonials that I've heard so far. Well, most of them. And anyway, but I guess my concern is, I didn't write anything down, so bear with me, please. But my concern is, while riding Max and the bus, I do ride regularly, and the streetcar, and I noticed that there aren't any emergency opening windows on the MAC, so I'm hoping that if there is funding provided and they bring in new, as they bring in new buses and everything, that they apply it to that type of thing, such as security. I think security needs to be improved. I noticed that there's only one or two, well, maybe four emergency buttons on the MACs, and all four of them are located only near the senior seating area or the handicap area, because they're considered the same. And so I was hoping that they would put some of those emergency buttons, like on all the MAX cars, like in the back and in the, you know, areas where everyone sits, and provide windows with that have emergency evacuation, I would think, for the buses and for people who have illnesses. For example, I have type 2 diabetes. If anything were to happen to me, I manage it pretty good, but if anything were to happen to me and I'm in the back of the bus or on the side where there are no emergency buttons, I would like to be able to let the driver know to stop the MAX or call emergency and help. So, and I'm thinking that would be important for anyone who has health issues or may have health issues.
Thank you very
much.
That's
all. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Let's see. Floyd, I can't read your last name. Stephanie Knoll and Leanne Ferguson, I think. You can start. Go ahead, please. Welcome.
All right. So I'm Floyd Miller. I'm 32 years old, and I live in North Portland. I think it's safe to say that a well-functioning, safe, and convenient public transportation system is paramount to a city the size of Portland. I'm personally a daily rider, and while I've seen many improvements in our current infrastructure, it's not perfect. Unfortunately, there isn't one change that can fix everything. Public transportation is constantly evolving, and as such, is one that needs to be on the forefront of everyone's mind to ensure that going forward, everyone has access to safe and fair transportation. The need for a transportation system not only extends to the equipment used in transporting the patrons, but the roads in which they drive as well. I know you might not be able to tell through my amazing beard, but a couple months ago, I ended up with two staples in my chin from running my chair into a pothole on the way to catch my train. So congestion, full buses, not enough handicap seating, and even physical safety are important, especially given the current situations that have happened. The problem is being faced daily by students, tourists, and other commuters. And these are ones that need to be addressed, and the solutions need to be ongoing because of the nature of the situation that these commuters face. And through this bill, I think that we could examine those situations and they could be addressed in the ever-growing, ever-evolving arena of public transportation.
Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Knoll. I'm a Portland resident and a member of the Beach Elementary School PTA. When my parents retired, they sold our family home and bought a small condo so they could afford to live in a neighborhood where they could enjoy an active, healthy retirement. They chose their neighborhood based on its safe places to walk and bike and easy access to transit so that they can remain active and connected in their community long after they feel it is no longer safe for them to drive. Staying involved in one's community after retirement should not be a luxury only some Oregonians can afford. Please invest in safe places to walk and bike in all of our communities. I am the sister to an awesome 35-year-old woman with Down syndrome. Her disability means that she will never drive, but because she has a bus pass and access to frequent service bus lines, her disability does not prevent her from working a part-time job, volunteering with two different organizations, and visiting friends and family. Our community benefits when everyone can contribute their time and talents, not just those that can drive. Please retain the full planned investment in transit operations in this bill. I'm also the parent to two active, wonderful six-year-old boys. We live just inside the one-mile radius of our neighborhood school. I want their whole route to school to be safe, not just the last quarter mile. Every morning, I see the children of hardworking Oregonians trying to navigate their way to school on foot and bike. Their parents can't be there to hold their hand. All our children should have access to bike and pedestrian safety education in schools and safe routes, especially low-income families at our Title I schools. Please include these amendments in the bill under the safe routes section. Increase the safety investments to $15 million and include the whole mile radius to schools for families that don't qualify for school busing. Include funding for bike and pedestrian safety education in schools so all those children can be safe. And please prioritize Title I schools. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. My name is Leanne Ferguson, and I am here representing the 125 organizations and thousands of individuals that make up the For Every Kid Coalition. Thank you guys for still being here. This is a long one. Over the past 10 years, I've had the opportunity to teach walking and biking classes to thousands of kids, lead walking school buses, facilitate street safety needs assessments, and organize walk to school days. And over the past 6 months, our coalition has held six town halls around the state, and we heard how Safe Routes to School programs help children with behavior issues, how it helps them succeed, how a student was hit at an intersection that was supposed to get a safety improvement but hadn't gotten the funding yet, how families and students need options for getting to school so they can graduate on time. We heard these things over and over again all over the state. What we are asking for as a coalition is Stephanie Knoll just talked about, as well as Robert Ping earlier. We would like to remove the 10-year sunset on the program and expand street safety funding to be $15 million per year. I know that the funding is supposed to last for 10 years and then achieve all of the projects within a quarter mile radius of schools. But I don't know how that's necessarily possible when the best research I've really seen on safe routes to school came out of Washington County last year, and they did a study on 53 schools, and those 53 schools needed about $100 million worth of improvements, just 53 schools in Washington County. So we really would like for it to bump those safety dollars up and remove the 10-year sunset. Also, funding in-classroom education is really important to our coalition and to Safe Routes to School. We know that we can generally see a 20% increase in kids walking and biking if you just fix projects outside of school, but with the education and encouragement, it bumps it up to 40%. So at a time when congestion is so bad and funding is so tight, these are the returns on investment that we just can't ignore. Please include a Title I prioritization for street safety projects, create flexibility in the local funding match requirement for Title I schools, and expand the radius for eligible projects around schools to 1 mile to account for that space where children aren't normally bused. The For Every Kid Coalition and I urge you to support these policy changes and make comprehensive and effective safe routes to school a priority. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. And let's see, Mac Rhodes family.
We've got three.
You got three? Oh, he's got little kids. We'll just do that. You got the whole family?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
All
right.
Take
it away.
Thank you. My name is Shane Mac Rhodes, and these are my kiddos, Isadora,
who is 8, and Gus and Ben, who are turning 7 in 2 weeks. We are from Eugene, and I am here with my family because we find this very important issue. But I'm also here representing the hundreds of families who would like to be here but are actually getting their kids to bed on time. I'm going to pay for this tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But it's important. We want to see a better transportation package for kids and families, one that focuses on better transportation options for everyone. One of the best ways to do this is to adopt the Safe Routes to School bill into the transportation bill. I feel like the transportation bill, the way it sits, the Safe Routes to School program is weak and is not going to accomplish what we need to accomplish. I want you to please improve it. The way it's currently laid out, we need to change to have more infrastructure, education, and culture change isn't going to happen without... we can't do this with just infrastructure. We have to look at education and encouragement. We have to focus on more than just a quarter of a mile. We have to build out a system, not just right around a school. And we have to focus on Title I schools and focus where the real need is. On a typical morning, my daughter Isadora rides a school bus because we are outside the one-mile zone. Ben likes to ride his bike with me, and Gus walks with his mom to another school. Other days, we all bike. We have transportation options because we have a community that focuses on safe routes to school. There are many communities throughout Oregon that do not. So in many ways, I'm speaking more for those other communities than our own. But there's a lot more that we need to do in our community as well, and we can't do it without a funding a transportation bill that really funds active transportation. Finally, one quick note on the bike tax for families. There are more families choosing cargo bikes to be car replacements. These bikes can range from $1,500 to $5,000 for e-assist cargo bikes. They're helping to create healthy, safer communities. We need to be encouraging their use and not making it more expensive and difficult for families to make this transportation choice. Also, quality kids' bikes can be as much as $500. I have 3 kids. Taxing their bicycles is just ridiculous. We have a car, we pay taxes, equal to many people who drive much more than we do. We are paying more than our fair share. The idea that bikes aren't paying their way is simply wrong. Everyone who knows transportation knows it. We know that that's a political move to help relieve the concern that bicyclists don't pay their way. We know that's not true. My kids are paying their way. We are paying our way. We ask that you build a stronger Safe Routes to School program with the transportation funding that we have. Give kids and families safer streets and better options. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Let's see. I think it's Meg Bergio, Sheila Griffin, and Jason Nolan. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Sheila Griffin, and I am a parent of 2 young adults and a member of the Brentwood-Darlington neighborhood and a bike safety educator, bike safety and pedestrian safety educator. I'm here tonight to specifically talk about the Safe Routes to School piece of the transportation funding package and implore you to increase the funding and add in-school education. I have been an educator for 8 years in the Portland area, and we are currently in a little bit less than half of the elementary age schools teaching pedestrian safety and bike safety. And my heart breaks, frankly, for the schools that don't get it and the students that don't get it. And Portland's community is actually doing quite well on that measure. And there are many communities around the state of Oregon that are not doing nearly as well. I wanted to share with you a couple of stories. One was from my pedestrian safety education class. A parent approached me and shared with me that after the class, going out for a walk with their student, the student actually stopped both the parents and educated them, the parents, on how to cross the street safely. That did my heart a world of good, and I feel like all students need to be getting this education. Regarding bike safety education, somebody mentioned earlier about how much better drivers these students will be once they've gone through that. I truly believe that because they are learning the laws and the rules of the road to an extent that I feel many drivers in our state don't have the same understanding. If our elementary students grasp the understanding of being a pedestrian and then at a later stage being a safe bike rider and following the laws of the road, they then, when they come to the point of being a driver, will be a much safer driver and much more knowledgeable about the rules of the road. So I am here today to ask you to increase the funding to $15 million for the Safe Routes to School package and include in-school education for every student in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I didn't see Jason Nolan. Is he here? Guess not. All right, so Matthew Williams, David Wilcox, and Jared Franz.
Good evening. My name is Matthew Williams. I'm from the southeast neighborhood of Mount Scott Arleta in Portland. And I just strongly would like to encourage you to increase the funding to $15 million and the scope of the program to include a one-mile radius from each school, as well as include in-class education. I feel like this will improve the safety of the roads for all users in the future by demonstrating proper behavior and have a profound impact on the safety for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Jared Franz. I'm the public policy coordinator for Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 757. ATU 757 is the labor union representing transit operators, mechanics, dispatchers, and other essential transit workers across the state of Oregon, from Portland to Medford, Tillamook to Prineville, and pretty much every major transit system in between. Proud to say that 100 years since our founding in Portland, we've grown to become the largest transit union in the entire Pacific Northwest. The elected leadership of our union have other commitments today and tomorrow, so I'm here on their behalf to tell you why thousands of active and retired transit workers in Oregon strongly oppose this transportation package as drafted. There must be substantially more money allocated to public transit, especially outside the Portland region, raised in a substantially more progressive way, with substantially more oversight of transit agencies for us to even begin reconsidering our position. This is not an opposition that ATU 757 makes lightly. Nobody in the state of Oregon is more committed to the growth and success of public transit than transit workers themselves. Likewise, nobody knows the challenges that public transit faces better than ATU 757 members, despite the fact that we weren't among the invited special guests who testified to this committee yesterday. Transit workers are the true experts on public transit in Oregon. As a democratic union that recognizes and respects the expertise of transit workers, we recently asked all 5,322 active and retired members of ATU 757 from every corner of this great state what they thought of this package. Members still have until Friday to return their surveys that we sent them, but the response to our survey has been overwhelming. And transit workers' expressed opposition to the package has been equally overwhelming. We intend to provide the public with our final survey results next week after our deadline has passed, but we have so far witnessed a ratio of about 3 to 4 transit workers in opposition for every transit worker in support. Simply put, Oregonians deserve and demand better from the package. This package is a masterpiece of compounding regressive taxation with one unfair tax on low-income and working-class Oregonians after another, after another, after another. Indeed, we couldn't identify a single progressive tax in the entire proposal that makes corporations, landlords, and the wealthiest Oregonians pay their fair share for essential transportation infrastructure and services. Transit workers in this state, like hundreds of thousands of other working folks, feel betrayed by Republicans and Democrats alike who refuse to fight for fair taxation and economic justice. The massive increase in state and regional gas taxes are a part of this proposal, are simply the tip of a regressive tax iceberg for low and middle income Oregonians. Retirees living on a fixed income have been especially vocal about their inability to afford these new taxes. And transit workers clearly understand the transportation impacts of Oregon's housing policies and skyrocketing rents that are forcing low and middle income people to live further and further away from the places they work, study, play, and pray. These struggles or displaced people are the ones who will bear the largest burden of the various regressive consumption and wage taxes in this package, not the corporations and the wealthy who will disproportionately benefit from the proposed investments. Echo chamber policy advocates respond to this concern by condescending to overburdened workers, telling workers that they know what's best for them, or suggesting that workers don't appreciate the benefits that new tax burdens will provide. Now, to be clear, we would be absolutely thrilled if public transit was a robust and viable alternative to driving for most Oregonians. That's the future we're fighting for, and it's a war that we're determined to win. But the future isn't here yet, and it's not even close. Not even in Portland, where we've spent billions and billions of dollars on transit infrastructure, but transit mode share is small and shrinking, in part because service is slower and less reliable than it's been in decades, in part because TriMet's budget priorities don't reflect rider and worker priorities, and in part because of the land use and housing crisis we've already mentioned. But the real kick in the teeth is that this package pretends to be pro-transit, while only allocating about 10% of the total new revenue to public transportation. This package doesn't meaningfully accelerate a future where public transit and active transportation options like walking and biking are the robust transportation options that Oregonians want and deserve. Moreover, the tokenized public transit expansion in this package is paid for by a regressive wage tax on all Oregon workers. ATU 757 members recognize this regressive wage tax on workers for what it really is, yet another way of letting corporations, landlords, and the wealthiest Oregonians avoid paying their fair share for public infrastructure and services. ATU 757 members also recognize that while the initial flat tax on the wages of all Oregonians is small, it is almost certain to grow over time and will effectively chill any future conversations about fairer, more progressive funding options. Almost done. Transit workers recognize that almost half of this new revenue would go to TriMet, while the 40 other transit districts and agencies in our state who actually need this revenue are left with crumbs from the table. And even if we could overlook the economic injustice of the proposed wage tax, in addition to the other regressive taxes and fees in the package, there is no faith among transit workers that the new revenue will be used in ways that reflect rider and transit rider and transit worker priorities. Indeed, by a greater than 9-to-1 ratio so far, Oregon's transit workers have told us that they do not believe transit agency governance and management is trustworthy, accountable, and using existing resources wisely. This is true at almost every transit provider in the state, not just at TriMet, and it's as close as a consensus as we've ever seen on a matter of public policy. Yet proposed accountability measures in the package are mostly post hoc and bureaucratic, with too little meaningful engagement of workers, riders, and most impacted communities. Real estate and business interests will continue to dominate transit priorities in the state, we have no doubt, and transit ridership will continue to stagnate. Even attempts to explicitly exclude light rail projects from the use of this new state revenue are hollow because there's no way to actually accomplish the prohibition in practice. One more paragraph. Yes, we can tell TriMet not to spend state money directly on light rail construction, which the bill does. But TriMet's growing debt payments, almost exclusively due to light rail financing, are considered a general fund operating expense, and the agency's budget is a shell game. Workers and riders both know this. In fact, the budget that TriMet just approved weeks ago includes $95 million transfer of general fund revenue into the agency's capital construction program.
Can I ask you to close that up, please?
Mm-hmm. When ATU 757 has finished collecting and fully analyzing the surveys we sent to the thousands of transit workers in our state, we'll continue return with concrete proposals for a fair deal. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Jim Howell, Zoe... Representative.
Mr. Franz, when you publish your survey, will you be publishing the questions that you sent out with it?
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Again, Jim Howell, Zoe Presson, and Mike Evans.
How's that? Okay.
Almost done, committee. Those who hung in there. please start.
My name is Zoe C.M. Presson. I am a member of TriMet's Committee on Accessible Transportation. I am also a member of the Special Transportation Fund Advisory Council. I am here to talk to you primarily about the livability of seniors and disabled people. We need livability. That means we need transportation. That's all I'm saying. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you. Please, whoever's next.
Hi. Thank you for hanging in there and staying this late. I'm Michael Evans. I'm a Salem resident and the co-leader of Salem Bridge Solutions Group. So thank you for allowing us to testify tonight concerning our need for the Salem River crossing. I represent a grassroots group of citizens named Salem Bridge Solutions. Our group was formed a month ago yesterday, and to date our electronic petition has 1,680 unduplicated signatures from residents of Marion and Polk counties, and I'll leave a copy for you. There's overwhelming support in our region for building the Salem River crossing for multiple reasons. The biggest concerns are public safety and environmental responsibility. Public safety is a huge concern with our current situation at both the local and statewide level. Locally, our only bridge dumps all traffic, including commercial vehicles, through our downtown traffic grid, creating serious congestion every day. On the many days where there's a traffic incident on or in the vicinity of the bridge, it becomes completely impassable. This creates a serious public safety issue as first responders can't get to residents suffering a serious health crisis or needing immediate assistance from police. The current bridge is two separate one-way structures. One is over 60 years old, and the other is 100 years old. Neither has been seismically upgraded or are likely to be standing in the case of a serious seismic event. When the Cascadia event inevitably occurs, Polk County will be cut off from Marion County, leaving almost no emergency services available to the Polk County residents.
Sir, it looks like you're reading that. Could you give that to us and just kind of sum it up, please?
Yeah. Let me give you the bottom line here is we need that bridge, and we're really hoping that this committee will move that up in the priority so that it makes the top priority. It's a significant issue for us. We have a growing population, 7.5% growth in the next 5 years in Salem. It's a daily problem right now, and it's getting worse by the day. So we appreciate your help with that.
Thank you very much. And please do turn that in so we can everybody has it. Sir.
Oh, my name is Jim Howell, co-chairs, member of the committee. I would like to ask you to eliminate about $750 million of projects that are earmarked in this bill, and those are the freeway projects around the Portland metropolitan area. They are intended to reduce congestion. They will do just the opposite. I would like to read just a short paragraph written by Joe Courtwright, a renowned economist in Portland, about what's called induced demand. One of the most consistent findings in transportation research is the principle of induced demand. Providing more roadway capacity in congested urban locations induces more trip making and more driving, which automatically means more carbon pollution. The phenomena is now so well documented that it's called the fundamental law of congestion. If we really care about climate change, the last thing we should be doing is building new or wider roads. And I just wish that you would eliminate these earmarked projects, because they're going in the wrong direction. Public transit could do the job on every one of these five projects better. Unfortunately, TriMet has not developed that are metro have not, don't seem to recognize those projects, but they would be, they could be half the price and far more effective in reducing congestion than these freeway widenings. And the only other thing I like to say is, in the last 30 years, our public transit in the state has gone downhill. Here's a map that the ODOT used to put out that has about 10 private bus companies used to provide much better service 30 years ago, and unfortunately, ODOT hasn't picked up the slack. And I wish that there was more in public transit here. It's nice to get something. $107 million, but that's that's a few crumbs, but it's better than nothing.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay, the last three, Ron Buell, UT, and Mike DeBlasi.
I'm Ron Buell from Portland, and I want to address Cliff Bence's remarks about accountable local governments. I used to live in Tillamook. That's where I was born and raised, and I could walk a couple blocks to City Hall or the county courthouse and talk to my commissioners. In Portland, there are 33 people on the TriMet board, the J-PACT committee, the Metro, the City Council, and the county commission. The Portland Bureau of Transportation has 750 employees, 95 engineers, and $350 million of a transportation budget annually. That's, I'm quoting this year's figure. So I'm here today to criticize, as Jim did, the program that you have. But I got to say, listening to this testimony today and seeing your patience, I'm just in awe of this committee and what it's done in putting together this big package. I mean, it's got a little something for everybody in it, and congratulations on your work. But I'd like to suggest that Webster's defines hypocrisy as feigning to believe what one does not, especially the false assumption of an appearance of virtue. And I'd like to suggest that many Oregon leaders are being hypocritical about climate change. Recent statements given by our U.S. senators and congressmen, our governor, the mayor of our state's biggest city, and the chief of our metro government all condemned President Donald Trump for taking the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Accords. But I've heard none of these leaders critically question the transportation package and the freeway expansion measures that are in that package. These freeway expansions will increase climate change by increasing driving. And that is a statement that is based on scientific fact and analysis. Surely all of you are aware that the goals set by this legislature for reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, 2040, and 2050 will now not be met, according to the chair of the State Commission on Climate Change, Angus Duncan. That's because as gas prices went down starting in 2015, people started driving more. You're all undoubtedly aware that 40% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions come from driving vehicles that use fossil fuels. And the best example we have of exactly how eliminating bottlenecks increase driving but does not eliminate congestion is the widening of the Sunset Freeway, Highway 26, from two lanes to three. Coming east in the a.m. rush hour, the bottleneck that existed out on the Sunset was simply moved to the single lanes after the tunnel at the bottom of the hill. And that's exactly what's going to happen on the more than $450 million project at the Rose Quarter. Going north, the traffic will soon back up from the state's worst bottleneck, where I-5 crosses the Columbia River. Going south, the traffic will back up going onto the Banfield via a single lane, or going onto the Morrison Bridge by a single lane, or going south on I-5 across Markham, where three lanes goes down to two pretty quickly. And so you're not going to be reducing congestion in that driving area. We spend a lot of money on these freeway expansions in your program, which makes the building trades and the oil auto dealers and the highway construction folks happy. And we increase driving by giving drivers the perception that there is more capacity in the roadways, but we don't reduce congestion. And the city of Portland's going to get another 250,000 people by 2035 living in the city. And there are a lot better strategies for getting those people out of their cars and getting other people out of their cars and for dealing with congestion. John Charles, who I disagree on a lot of stuff, but he talked about congestion pricing, and we need to get after it. And I'd like to suggest that the two bridges across the Columbia would be good places to start a program of congestion pricing during the rush hours. Also, I agree with what Jim Hall said about transit. We need to spend a lot more money on transit in the metro area and not on freeway expansions. And finally, on providing an urban design framework that enables people to walk and bike to shopping and jobs. That's not what this transportation package does. Thank you for your time and your patience in staying here this long tonight.
Thank you. Greetings, committee chairs and members. My name is Yute. I'm testifying as a tech worker, business owner in the Hollywood District, and a board member, past officer of our local business association. I'm also a bicyclist and a driver. I am in support of HB 3199 and would like the committee to consider that we learn from other rail systems like in Korea and Japan. They charge low fees, but they also use fee attendants, and they are funded with a public-private hybrid model with vendors selling services in the transit center, kind of like in our airports. Checking for fees can help address safety concerns, which is a real deterrent to ridership. The attacker who killed two riders and injured a third a couple weekends ago in the Hollywood Transit Center was identified as a homeless person and was possibly a fee skipper, implying that the tragedy that had occurred could possibly have been prevented by a fee attendant. Additionally, I'd like to address HB 3200. I believe it's a mistake to add more lanes to existing freeways in the Portland metro area. I think that we need to solve the suburban, I think that we need to shelve the suburban model with connecting big freeways to the city center. LA's I-405 was completed after 4 years and billions of dollars, and traffic congestion is reported as just as bad or worse as it was. Instead, I would like the committee members to consider working to the strength that Portland has, to focus on better urban design that encourages people to live and work within walkable or bikeable distances, with more safe and more affordable public transportation, connecting the walkable neighborhoods. As a tech worker and business owner, I'm well aware that my industry is an economic engine for the state, and that much of the economic growth that we've experienced and projected experience is with people in their 20s and 30s, many of them tech workers who prefer living and working inside the city and who are attracted to Portland by our walkable neighborhoods. Let us maintain our existing roads and highways throughout the state that are long overdue for repairs. Let's invest more in public transportation, focusing on safety with fee inspections and providing more services for transit riders, paid for with a public-private hybrid model. Let's not tax electric cars and bicycle riders, which suppress alternative fuel activities that are needed to reduce carbon levels. Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate that you stayed.
Thank you.
For me. Thank you.
Sir. Thank you, too, for staying so late. I think the sun is still up. So, good evening. My name is Mike DeBlasi. I'm a resident of Kaiser, and I work in Salem. I come to you tonight to voice my opposition to the bill. While there are some good parts, the whole is not. Oregon does have a transportation problem, but this bill will do nothing to solve it. It will only delay the inevitable and lead us to being less fiscally secure. There's one reason why Oregon has a shortage of transportation funds and worsening traffic delays. We've massively spent on highways and roads that are supporting auto-centric development. Since the mid-20th century, the state and the highway department has spent billions of dollars focused almost exclusively on building and widening high-speed roads that are to the detriment of both our communities that they serve and the travelers on these roads. This bill continues that massive subsidy to single-passenger vehicle travel. In this bill, you are either directly spending money to widen highways around the metro region or supporting additional spending on highways and bridges around the Mid-Willamette Valley. By focusing on expanding capacity on highways around the metro region and the Mid-Willamette Valley, we are ignoring the market signals that are telling us there are enough travelers to support robust transit, and we incentivize travelers to continue driving alone in their personal vehicles. Pricing, either time or money, is how we determine people's preferences among competing transportation options. High price invites substitution, but when the state comes in and subsidizes only one transportation option, the market is subverted. And these costs are transferred to all Oregonians, regardless of where they live, whether it be financial, environmental, or through hardships, both economic and social. Instead of preserving road capacity, these local politicians that are in favor of this bill, they will permit auto-centric development, which quickly eliminates any time efficiency gained by this additional road capacity. We should not be rewarding their bad decisions. I ask you, those of you who care about climate change, to ask yourselves how adding more cars to the roads will help combat this crisis. I ask you, those of you who are advocates for poor and middle-class Oregonians, how having them spend more money on cars and housing because there are no options will help them. And I ask those of you who are fiscally conservative and do not believe in government subsidies or the government creates jobs, how you think massive subsidies to the road construction industry and auto-centric development industries that weaken our city's financial health is any better than throwing money off the Capitol's roof. So my suggestions are return all the roads within UGBs to local jurisdictions and require that all jurisdictions pay for all road building and maintenance. Reduce ODOT's role to maintaining the interstates and primary highways, freight rail, ports, and intercity transit, and toll non-commercial vehicles on highways between Eugene and Vancouver and the surrounding areas, and raise gas tax and other fees to cover all maintenance costs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Graham, thanks for hanging in there.
You bet. I get the
parting shot. You're last.
co-chairs, co-vice chairs, members of the committee, my name is Graham Traynor. I'm the chief of staff of the Oregon AFL-CIO, the statewide federation of labor unions representing over 300,000 working women and men in every corner of the state, and we're a voice for all workers in the legislative process. Really appreciate all your time this evening and throughout the last couple of years in pulling together a really comprehensive, bold, visionary package, which we're really proud of. The State Federation of Labor has been the long-term advocate for an economy that works for all Oregonians, and a believer in the notion that a well-maintained, well-funded, robust transportation system is an important underpinning to a healthy economy. Unfortunately, as you all are keenly aware of, this is certainly not the case in Oregon today. So a good bill should pass. We support the package, but I do want to say one quick thing, and it's not probably surprising, and I've said this to some of you, one issue of concern is the worker-only payroll tax to fund transit. We're very much in support of transit investments as a way to create jobs and give Oregonians more transportation options. But as you might imagine, we'd like to see this portion of the package be equally shared by employers as well. Additionally, we expect that serious efforts be made to do more for low-income workers and transit users as it relates to low-income fares and other mitigation efforts to ease the burden of this package on the lowest-wage workers. Again, we look forward to working with you to pass this important, bold, visionary package. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Graham. Members, thanks for hanging in there. We've completed the list. So we are adjourned. 5 o'clock.